the Splash Page Podcast, episode number 50. I'm Chad Nevin, and with me is...
Tim Callahan. For the last time, Chad, what's going on with this episode?
Oh, I don't know.
It's our last episode of the Splash Page Podcast. That's what's going on.
Yeah, because you quit.
Yeah, I'm quitting. This is my last episode. Yeah. And therefore, it's your last episode. Because you're a quitter, too.
Oh, because I'm just being like the Splash Page is you and me, so I'm not continuing on without you. That makes me a quitter.
Yeah, I guess so.
I thought that made me loyal.
You are loyal. You're a good man.
There we go.
I was interested to see if you were going to continue without me, who you would get, because I would listen to every single episode. So actually, you know what? Like, one of the reasons why I'm walking away from the show is because it's like, oh, well, it'll save me 2 or 3 hours every week where I can actually get stuff done and spend time with my family. But what would end up happening is I would just listen to you talk to somebody else for 2 or 3 hours. So I'm glad you're not continuing, because in the long run, I would gain absolutely nothing from it.
Yeah. Well, I'm not... Well, I'd, prefer to continue on, honestly. I can't be too upset about suddenly having my Friday nights back.
Yeah.
And not being forced often to stay up till 1 a.m. before I have to get up to go to work at 8.
Yeah, so you win, ultimately.
Yeah, it's a good thing. But I would have kept doing it anyways, because I enjoy it.
Yeah, I enjoy the talking.
Yeah, I'm not sure who I would get. I mean, I've done stuff with, like, Sean Witzke, but I don't think he or I would want to do that. I don't think it would work well for our schedules to do it every week. I'm not sure what his schedule's like, but I don't think he'd be up for doing something every week. I'd be happy to talk to him every week, but I just don't think that would work out, ultimately. Other than that, I don't know. That's the thing, I can't think of anybody else who I'd really want to talk to, like, once a week that I can say for sure, and that would be willing to talk once a week and read enough comics to talk once a week, that sort of thing.
Brian Michael Bendis.
Okay, yeah, if Bendis wants to, fill your spot, I'll keep doing it.
Okay, or Joe Casey, either one.
I don't know. I have a feeling that would eventually just end with him and me hating each other, and it ending in like a big blood feud between the two of us. I don't know why.
I did at one point invite Tom Scioli to be on the show on your blog.
Yeah, after he commented on the Joe Casey thing.
And then we never had him on the show. But we'll have to do that. We'll have to have some eventual reunion when we all happen to be at the same convention somewhere. And we'll have to record some kind of segment. That will probably be like 2015, though, so don't wait for it.
Yeah, well, that's what I was saying before. It shouldn't even be, like, planned. It should be, as I said, like, we're at a convention, and we just start doing it randomly in front of people who don't have any idea what the hell's going on. So then all the people who care aren't actually there, and they get pissed off when they read about how it happened.
It's the ultimate take that, everybody who's not in the know. We're so cool. We're just going to sabotage everything to make some inside reference that nobody gets.
That sounds very much like me, actually. Yeah.
So, yes, we're ending the show after... How long have we been doing this? For at least a year and a half.
It's not quite a year. I think we started last... In
January?
Either February or March. That's not a year and a half. That's a little bit over a year, but that's okay. That's cool.
But if you combine our original... typewritten discussions that started way back on the SecWart website while that was still around.
Yeah.
We've been doing this forever. Forever. I mean, think of what has happened since we started doing the splash page in some form or another.
3 years have passed.
At that time, I was just a teacher, not writing for CBR. You were...
A graduate student.
Graduate student... You hadn't met your girlfriend yet?
Had not.
You weren't writing for CBR, certainly.
Oh, God, no.
In that time, I've gotten 3 other jobs. You've gotten a job and a long-term relationship.
Yep.
And we've written, combined, over 1,000 reviews for CBR.
Oh, easily.
Easily over 1,000 reviews.
Well, I'm at almost 700 myself, and you were probably around that when you...
I was around that, too.
Yeah, wow. See, look at that. Another time you quit.
Yeah, I don't miss it.
Why you always
I don't miss
chance.
That at all. I did. I really did enjoy going back to write a few reviews. Like when Jonas said, "Hey, you want to review this and this?" I said, "Sure," but yeah, I don't. I certainly don't miss that. That's one of the reasons that I want to take a break from podcasting for a while, an extended.
See,
break.
That's the thing. I think you just get down on the weekly grind of things.
It's not just that. It's that my wife's done with her bowling league on Friday, so like she's home every Friday, so it's kind of awkward not to spend time with her when that's the only time we really have to spend together. But also, I love comics, and I know Jason Horn on Twitter commented like he's curious to see if I'll stop buying comics because I'm not always reading them, but I still read a ton of comics. I don't always necessarily read all the comics that I buy on Wednesday by Friday, but I read easily 30 comics a week, including collected editions and stuff, easily, every week. And I love comics, but I am curious to see if, without doing the reviews and without the sort of impulse to read new stuff because we're going to talk about it on the podcast, I'm curious to see if I will really pare back my weekly reading, and then I'll probably still buy a lot of stuff and then just save it up and read it all in one sitting. But, I'm curious to see if that affects what I focus my attention on, because I certainly have a ton of collected editions I haven't read, and I do prefer to read longer runs, or at least story arcs, than single issues, and then I forget what happened in the issue from a month or two ago. So I'm curious to see about that. Plus, we can't do the podcast forever, so might as well step away at a nice round number. Well, it wasn't like I wasn't going to leave it episode like 57. That's a weird number to walk away on.
That's true. Episode 50, like after just over a year, seems a little odd too, somehow.
No, it's a milestone.
Except it's really not the 50th episode.
It's not.
It's the 50th official episode, but
it's good enough.
And then I guess we do count all like the point episodes as like one episode of whatever week that was. Because those were like one, it's just we stopped chopping episodes up.
Right. We recorded it in one sitting, but we chopped it up.
Except for the few times when like stuff would cut out, and it's like, that seemed like a good breaking point. I guess we'll just end and begin episodes there.
And so if anybody cares, the plan is we'll keep this stuff up for a little while, not much longer. Then Chad's going to erase everything from the splashpage.podomatic.com, which means our iTunes feed will go dead. And then I'm not going to be paying for this Podomatic site anymore. And we will try to find a place to archive at least the Joe Casey episode and maybe the last episode. And if anybody's curious, our very first raw, unprofessional, not that this is super professional by any means, version of the Splash Page podcast is still available online because it was never on this feed to begin with. It was always at the geniusboylive.podomatic.com site and the Genius Boy Live feed on iTunes. And that has our very first Chad and Tim Splash Page episode, which sounds a lot different because it has different music, just like this episode does, but also it has me doing the recording, and we lost a bunch of the audio because my computer kept crashing, and our voices sound different because it's recorded on a different computer. And we're probably a year and a half dumber than we are now.
Definitely a year and a half dumber.
Although, if memory serves me, wait, let me load this up and see. I'm pretty sure we talked about the same stuff we always talk about, like
probably
comics, Jeff Johns comics, Grant Morrison comics.
Let me see.
Sad but true. What did we talk about in that very first episode? And this was, what was the date we posted it? Yeah, January 24th, 2010. Jeff Johns, Warren Ellis, comic book reviews, and the good and the bad of the century. We definitely don't talk about the century anymore. That's a good thing, because he's dead.
Yeah, we don't, but yeah, otherwise, wow, I didn't. Oh yeah, you posted that, so you didn't really take good notes.
Good notes? What else is there besides Warren Ellis, Jeff Johns, and comic book reviewery? There was probably no Grant Morrison comic that week, otherwise we would have talked about him too. That's all we got. And maybe some Jim Starlin for fun, and maybe a Howard Chaykin reference here and there. We are so predictable, it's sad.
I know, that's what I feel kind of bad when I get into like these little things of being obsessed with something, where it's like, hey, look at my random thoughts for the past 2 months. least every single one involves a reference to martial law. And none of them, like, insightful or anything like that. It's more just, like, a random throw-off, like, I read this, I liked it.
Yeah, everybody's got those quirks, and I wouldn't say I'm self-conscious about mine, but as a teacher for over 12 years, I know that I have certain habits and traits that the kids could easily mimic, and so you become self-conscious and self-aware of those things. And I'm sure that happens on the podcast, too. If we listened to all these episodes back-to-back, which some people probably do, and good for them. I feel sorry for them, but they do. You'll clearly notice that we probably say the same things over and over in the same ways.
Oh, God, yes.
That's comforting, perhaps.
Oh, God, yes.
All right, what are we talking about?
I didn't mention it, but yeah, the song that kicked off the podcast is a song called 50 Gallon Drum by Buck 65.
It's my favorite song.
You've never heard it before.
I've never heard it. You sent it to me. I still haven't listened to it.
Yeah, this week I sent him like four possible options for new intro music, and his response was, "Yeah, I'm done with this stuff."
Yeah, it was the choice between the four songs. I was like, "Screw that! I don't want to make any choices ever again. I'm done."
Yeah.
It was I wasn't sure last week. I wasn't sure. I was like, "Am I really gonna not?" With the podcast, and then over the weekend I thought about it. I was like, yeah, I think the 50th episode is probably my last, but I didn't really make up my mind until I thought about it after your email.
It's like, I have to listen to 4 30-second clips, or I could quit.
Exactly.
I think
I'll walk away.
It's like 4 30-second Canadian musician things that I've never heard of these people.
Yes. Yes, yes. And, you know, I don't think this will be my last podcast ever, but it's certainly the last one for a little while. And
until you show up next week on some other show.
Yeah, I've actually joined the cast of another show.
Oh, yeah, I was totally prepared for you to be, like on Monday to announce some big new gig, and it's like, oh, that son of a bitch.
No. Well, it's like when I stopped doing reviews. I said, okay, I'm going to stop doing reviews, and I'm going to work on my own creative stuff. And I haven't worked on my own creative stuff at all. I just spent more time reading comics and relaxing. That's fine. I don't mind doing that. I could use more of that because I work a ton of hours. My jobs keep me busy. I work dozens and dozens of hours a week. I don't even know. I must work like 60 to 70 hours a week if I add up all the time I'm working from home. It's a lot.
I don't work that much. Well, not to your extent. Especially like at my paid day job. I work when they pay me, and otherwise, I don't.
That's a job, not a career. That's what happens.
Yeah. And then even on the weekends sometimes, even when they're paying me, I don't.
That is a job.
Yeah. The best part about that job is on the weekends when I write reviews for CBR at work, it's like getting paid twice to review comics.
It's double dipping.
It's totally double dipping.
I was thinking how you could triple dip, but you're not really in a position to do that.
I guess the closest I could come is doing that when I'm doing like a holiday shift.
Or writing a review that you have a book deal to publish later.
Ooh.
For CBR. So you'd get paid for the review, plus paid for the review by the book publisher, in theory, plus paid for working at your real job. Quote.
That's right.
That would be triple dipping, and that would be amazing.
I think Jonah needs to actually launch a line of books and start off with the collected reviews of Chad Nevitt.
That would be pretty good.
Actually, I don't think that'd be good at all.
That'd be pretty good. Hey, the reviews that we've written over the years, out of the 1,000, I'm sure out of the 1,400, some are worth reading again.
Yes, some, not a book's worth.
At least. Do you ever read those Leonard Maltin film books? Those are junk reviews, and he gets paid tons of money to publish those books.
That's true. I was actually trying to think of how many like books have come out of CBR, and I think there's only been Warren Ellis' Come In Alone, and CBR didn't even publish that. AIT Planet Lair did.
Right. No, there was also Gail Simone's stuff was published.
Oh, yeah, it was. You'll Be Sorry or You'll All Be Sorry, whatever was it. What was the official? Was it You'll Be Sorry or You'll All Be Sorry?
you'll all be sorry, because it was Yabs.
Yes. And it wasn't AIT Planet Lair who published that. Was it IDW, maybe?
I don't remember.
I want to say it was IDW or maybe Devil's Due. Those would be my two guesses.
I do know that Jonah gave me permission to publish any of my stuff elsewhere.
Considering the number of columns I've seen that have been like prep work for like a SecWort thing.
Well, like two columns. It's not a ton.
I guess it's only been two.
So I tried to enter SecWort. I was like, hey, how about we just do a collection of my columns? And they were like, yeah, you can take these columns and you can expand them and add chapters on this, this, and this. I was like, no, I don't want to do any extra work. I just want you to take the columns. Like, I'll change a few words, but I'm not going to expand or add new ones. I just want you to publish what I've already done, because otherwise that would be a lot more work. Yeah, I don't think you understand how this is supposed to operate. You're supposed to pay me for work that I've already done and then put another book on my resume. I like all those things.
Well, actually, I think they should just hire somebody to transcribe all the podcasts, publish that as a book.
Hell yeah, but we don't even have the early podcasts. They're gone.
I'm sure somebody has them still.
Joey, do you have them? Joey has them, probably.
I think somebody must have, like, downloaded them and then never deleted them. There's bound to be that one person, but they're probably not listening anymore, and they probably just, like, have them somewhere. I assume that somehow, like, in that whole, like, computers never delete everything officially, I probably still have them somewhere on my hard drive secretly that I'd need someone who's smart to access them.
So I was... this reminded me of something, and you'll see where I'm going with this. So I was at a conference a couple weeks ago. We have to prepare for our school's reaccreditation, which happens every 10 years. It's an ongoing process, but you have to get visited every 10 years, but you're always working towards reaccreditation in the meantime. The guy who was running the workshop, he's a retired school administrator who's in charge of this accreditation stuff now. We asked him, as a relatively forward-thinking district, not forward-thinking for anybody who's actually listening to his podcast, but for a public school district, it's forward-thinking. And we said, well, when you guys come in and look at evidence and look at portfolios, do you want them to be actual big chunky binders, or do you want them to be digital portfolios? And he was clearly frightened by that question. As in, like, oh, I don't know about this digital stuff. He said, you might want to have the binders, but, you know, if you want to put something on a CD, that would be okay, too. And all I was thinking was, who the hell uses CDs anymore? Oh, Chad Nevitt does. That's who uses CDs still.
I love CDs.
So I thought of you. I honestly have never heard anybody in the past, I don't know, 5 years talk about burning something to a CD. But this guy did.
I bought 3 new CDs this week.
And they are good?
They're good. New Sam Roberts album, new Buck 65 album, CeeLo's album. Or newest album, I guess, because he's had previous ones.
I can't tell you the last time I bought a CD. It was probably like a Weezer album or something.
Yeah. Me? 3 days ago.
I have bought albums from iTunes, but nothing in the past year. Because I just spend my time listening to our podcasts over and over and over.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's what I do. I do not do that.
I don't know who would. I'm scared of who would, actually. That's actually what we should be afraid of now, is the weird person who listens to our podcasts over and over again, who will hear this and then hunt us down and kill us.
Or have us perform his own private podcast.
Ooh, kidnapped.
Yeah.
That's tough to pull off, though, because we live in two different countries. Granted, not, like, super far away from each other, two different countries, but still, transporting bodies across borders. That's tough to do.
Well, it's like the plot of King of Comedy, but with podcasting, so it's more hip for the younger crowd.
Yeah, except, just so the guy knows, even if you're pointing a gun at me when we're trying to cross the border, I'm still going to tell them what you're doing. You may be able to shoot me, but screw you. I'm not going to give you the satisfaction.
Listen, you can't even bring comic books across the border to the Toronto Comics Arts Festival without those getting confiscated. I'm pretty sure you're not going to be able to bring an abducted citizen across the border.
Well, if the person's cool and doesn't, like, imagine being abducted. So, I mean, like, I pretty much just put it in his court where if the person's going to do that, they have to kidnap you and bring you across into Canada. because I've clearly stated I'm not going to the U.S. if I'm kidnapped.
Hmm. Interesting. Would I go to Canada if I'm kidnapped? Well, I don't think I'm going to answer that question.
You've got so much more to live for than I do, though.
I do. I have a ton of hardcovers I have to read still.
I was more referring to your wife and children.
Those two.
Whereas, you know, I have a long-term girlfriend who I love very much, but, you know, she's my girlfriend. She's not, like, my wife.
Right. Everybody's got tons of girlfriends. I mean, those are easy to find.
No, I just got the one. And
okay.
That took a lot of long, hard work to find. And I'm still amazed that it happened somehow.
Well, it's probably your deep love for comic books. Works every time.
Probably not.
Hey, it worked for me.
Did it?
No. No. I did have... I'm thinking because my wife and I met in college. I did have, I'm not even kidding, a Jerry Ordway Power of Shazam poster on my dorm room door.
Ooh.
And it was, I think, the only comic book thing I had. And the reason I got it was because it wasn't a shop I normally went to, but the shop that was near my college gave it to me. And so I was like, well, I'll hang it up then. I don't care. So maybe that was the babe magnet that Jerry Ordway, Captain Marvel.
Hey, on my second date with Michelle, she came over to my place to watch, like, a movie. And to pick the movie, we went into my room to look at my list of DVDs on my computer, because I keep a list of all the DVDs I own. You know, for just such an occasion, when you're like, what do you want to watch? Here's my list of DVDs, so you can see what I have.
I used to have a list of DVDs. I gave up on that after DVD, like, 1,472 or something.
Wow, I'm not that high at all.
Yeah, it was over 1,400, because I was keeping a numbered list, and I said, that's too many, I'm going to stop keeping track, because it's embarrassing.
What number am I at, just out of curiosity? I think it's just around 400. 403. With almost 100 of those are like TV show sets.
Yeah.
And then a surprising, not necessarily surprising, but a big chunk of them now are starting to become wrestling DVDs.
Oh, that's like my brother. He had entire rooms in his apartment devoted just to his wrestling DVD collection. As in, he needed that much space to put them in. Not as in he had a shrine, just like he had a lot of shelves and they were just all wrestling DVDs. He easily had over 1,000 wrestling DVDs.
Well, I'm at the point now where actually I don't feel the strong desire to buy wrestling DVDs because I have, like, there's so many I haven't watched yet.
Mm.
That I'm like, I don't feel right spending money on more of these until I, like, knock down a bunch. But yeah, getting back to my other story. Michelle, in my room, looking at my DVD list on my computer. But this was at, like, my basement apartment, where, like, all my DVDs and books were kind of, like, in boxes still, because why would I unpack them to a place that I'm going to move out of within the next year or so easily?
Mm-hmm.
And we're talking, like, stacks of comics and boxes of comics and stuff like that, too. That didn't put her off at all, so.
She didn't run away.
And now... It's in her apartment, so...
Sucker.
Exactly. The ever-expanding pile of comics.
Yeah, my wife likes to say that I kind of misled her in some way. As in, like, she didn't realize that I was really into comics this much. And I said...
Well, at the time, were you really into comics this much?
I didn't have as much money.
Didn't you go through a period of not really being into comics as much?
No.
I thought there was a period where you stopped buying them or kind of drifted away for a little bit.
That has never happened to me. The only time that's even come close to happening was when I was in high school it was literally 3 months. I just didn't buy some comics off the rack every week. But other than that, and I was still reading comics at the time, just not the ones that were brand new. Other than that, I've literally gone to the shop every week to buy comics.
Oh yeah, you're like me. I haven't gone to the shop like every week, but I think like you and I are the only people that I can think of. And some person will correct me, but like in our, let's say, expanded circle of people who hasn't gone through that period of just like not reading comics and then came back at some point. Yeah, no, that's the thing. Like, I don't think it ever occurred to you or I to give up comics in the same way like it wouldn't occur to us to give up movies or books or anything.
No, but I have done that thing where I look at my shelves that are filled with stuff I still haven't read, especially all these newspaper reprints that I want to read, just collected edition, Omnibu. Like I own the first two original Silver Age Iron Man omnibus editions. I've never read more than the first. I've read the origin story, but I've never read a single issue beyond that. I've always think, and so I've sat there looking at these things and saying, yeah, I'm not going to buy any more books until I read these. And then less than 12 hours later, I order something on Amazon or
make another purchase. That wouldn't be giving up comics. That would just be giving up buying stuff until you've...
Right, but I can't even do that, so...
Yeah, but I mean, like, that's the way, like, when I was out of work, like... Well, I bought comics because of the reviewing gig, but I mean, like, I didn't buy hardly any new, like, CDs, books, or DVDs, but I wouldn't say I gave up on those. It's just I didn't buy new ones that I didn't already own.
Yeah, that's an interesting thing. With DVDs, I would say from 1999, that's when I got a DVD player, through 2008, probably, or at least, 2008. I bought DVDs every week. I would buy whatever was the coolest of the new releases. And, of course, during a lot of that time, stuff was coming out on DVD for the first time. So there was, like, always old stuff that was coming out or relatively recent stuff. And so there's always something to buy that was good and interesting. And then I just, well, like a lot of people, after all the good stuff had already come out, and then they were just triple and quadruple dipping, I just stopped. And then once I switched to Netflix last year, I just like completely stopped buying DVDs. And I don't miss buying DVDs at all. And I also don't even really watch movies anymore. That also has to do with my kids being older. When they were younger, you could watch movies because they were too young to understand what was going on or they were sleeping. But now they're around, so you have to watch movies that are appropriate for them, basically. So that really curbs the ability to watch most interesting movies that come out.
Okay, you know what really curbs it? Probably your idea of what's appropriate. See, right there, see, you're limiting yourself just based on this silly idea of what's appropriate and not appropriate.
Yeah, so, no, I don't think it's a very silly idea.
I don't know. Again, you're talking to the guy who read martial law as a kid.
Yeah.
Again, I'm screwed up in various ways.
As a parent, you can't do that. I know what you mean. You can't. There's certainly a whole bunch of movies that you can't show.
Like what?
The kids are around. Like anything where they're dropping the F-bomb left and right. That is wildly inappropriate.
Okay, only if you explain to me what's actually offensive about the word fuck.
Because you don't want little kids thinking that it's okay to talk that way. It's really disturbing. When little kids are exposed to that kind of language and then use it, it's not appropriate for them to act that way. If you want to be a bad parent, you can do that.
See, I don't understand why that's bad, though. It's more about the word itself, that nobody's ever actually explained to me what's actually bad about it.
If you
Other
were...
Other than the arbitrary someone at some point decided they thought it was a bad word.
If you were in a job interview you really wanted to get, would you use that word?
Okay, that's not actually telling me why it's inappropriate. You're just saying society thinks it's inappropriate, so you shouldn't use it.
Yeah, but that's the whole point. But that is the point. And people,
oh, no, I understand, but I'm saying...
People will judge you on that, specifically that word, and the connotation of any kind of offensive language is a powerful thing. So you have to be careful. And you certainly don't... I mean, yeah, my kids know those words. I mean, they go to school. They know those words. They go on a school bus.
See, but right there, that's what makes it even funnier. It's like, people are like, we can't let them hear those words. Oh, they know those words, but we can't let them hear them.
No. You can't establish an environment in which those words are appropriate.
Apparently, you send them to that environment 5 days a week.
No. So you can't establish an environment. It's different when you send them there and they hear it. It's different between that and saying, it's okay to use them in this context. It's not okay to use them in this context.
Why can't you explain it's okay to use it in the context of being in a fictional movie? So when they're in a fictional movie, they can use those words.
That's a good point. That would be, yeah.
Wouldn't that actually be the context of seeing it in a movie? That's a fictional thing right there. The same way, like...
Chad, you're not going to win this argument.
I'm not going to win this argument.
That way. That's bad parenting.
Well, you let your son watch wrestling. He knew not to perform those violent moves, did he not?
It's very different.
How's that different than telling him not to use a word?
It's completely different. Because he cannot do those violent moves. Like, it is physically impossible for him to do that. He could use that word. And I'm not saying he would. I know he wouldn't. That's not the point. The point is establishing a culture in which that kind of language or action or, you know, extreme violence where their brains are getting blown out, in which that is appropriate. It's not appropriate for little kids. There's no way you can make the argument that it is. If you raise little kids on that sort of thing, then you're potentially providing them with a corrupt view of everything. You want to try to provide them with a view of life that's a little more safe and secure than that. You don't want psychological damage to incur in their formative years.
Yeah.
You are a bad test case on this, so we're moving on.
Yeah, there's really, let's be honest, you know I'm saying half this stuff just because I find it amusing to say half this stuff.
Yeah, you don't have kids, so.
It has nothing to do with that. It has to do
with
me.
It totally does. Ask anybody who is a parent with young kids.
I think if I had kids, I would still be putting forth these arguments. I just wouldn't be actually acting on them in my real life.
You wouldn't even be putting forth the arguments because you would realize they are silly.
Oh, no, I realize they're silly now. When has that ever stopped me?
You wait. You have kids, and you see. You'll be like, oh, yeah, that was dumb for me to say because I didn't know what I was talking about. I was just saying stuff.
What happens if I actually don't change at all?
You will.
What happens if I don't, though?
I feel bad for everybody involved.
Yeah, over the word fuck, because, geez, that's such a bad word. For reasons that nobody can ever explain.
What do you mean?
What is intrinsically offensive about that word?
Nothing is intrinsically offensive. There's nothing intrinsic about any word. Every word has a meaning because people have agreed upon the meaning. That's it.
Yeah, but what is the meaning of that word beyond it's offensive? It has no other meaning.
It is forbidden, and it's a signifier of a certain attitude. You just don't want to accept the world as it is, Chad. You want it to be different.
Yeah, because the world as it is kind of dumb most of the time.
That's the way it is.
Randomly picking a word that's offensive for no other reason than everybody just decided it's offensive.
Yes.
That's really dumb.
Well, it's offensive like a lot of the curse words.
Yeah, most of them I don't find offensive.
Because it's from Old English instead of Latin. That's why it's offensive. It is. All the curse words are from Old English because the sophisticated people spoke Latin and didn't use those words.
Yeah, I'm just saying. I understand certain words actually being genuinely offensive to people. Stuff like regular swear words, I can never get behind that mentality. I just can't.
Am I personally offended by it? No, because I also work in a school, and I use those words in my own private life. But that doesn't mean I'm going to create a situation in which young children are exposed to that all the time, because that seems irresponsible.
Yeah, but if everybody says it, it can't be offensive anymore. Take away the power, man. Take away the power.
It still is.
Take it away.
I don't think so. I think its power is perfectly appropriate. It's good that it has power. Why take away the power of a word? Why would you do that, Chad? Then words don't have meanings anymore. See, you don't even want to take away its power.
I don't.
Exactly.
But I'm still going to complain about it the way I do right now.
I hear you saying that. Let's talk about comic books, because we like those, and they have swears in them sometimes, especially Vertigo comics.
Especially Vertigo comics.
That would be, if I were to write a book about Vertigo, that's what it would be titled. They have swears in them sometimes. The History of Vertigo Comics.
Wow.
So, I'm just going to jump into this because I'm sure we have regular comics to talk about. But you haven't seen the Thor movie yet, right?
No, I have not.
In my post-Thor fascination, where I was like, oh man, what kind of Thor collected editions are available? I own all the Walt Simonson stuff. I own a lot of Thor single issues. I own some of the Dan Jurgens stuff. I was like, oh, I'll just order all the Dan Jurgens run. Like, why not? I didn't actually do that, but I ordered some. But I got World Engine.
So Warren Ellis.
Read Warren Ellis's Thor. I have two questions.
Go ahead.
When you read it at the time it was coming out, that's where you started on Thor, right?
No, that's not where I started on Thor. I'd started on Thor a little bit before. I started on Thor, like, really reading Thor at Blood and Thunder.
How long before World Engine was that?
A couple years, maybe a year or two.
So then World Engine came in and really shook things up?
World Engine changed the way I read comics from that point on.
Okay, so when you read it originally, did it seem like one of the crappiest looking comics you've ever seen? Or did it seem appropriate for the time?
Trust me, if you saw those Thor comics that came before it, even now, you would be like, okay, that was a big step up.
Because it's a horrible looking comic. And I'm not even saying Diodato's art is bad, but it's pretty bad. But the thing that makes it so horrible is that in every issue, there's all of a sudden a random sideways sequence.
Yeah, that was kind of odd.
And there's no reason for it, and it's physically disjointed because it jumps from this one thing to a sideways. There's also a couple transitions that are disjointed, and like I really don't know what's going on in some of the transitions. But man, it is a visual mess of a comic book. And also, my other question is, what was the deal with that phase of Warren Ellis? When he's doing that, and he's doing his X, was he doing X-Factor?
Excalibur.
Between Pete Wisdom and the police officer character he throws in here, was he just, like, throwing in his version of John Constantine into every comic he was writing?
I would say it's his version of John Constantine. I'd say it's more just the same way, like, Jenny Sparks is a variation on that character, or Spider Jerusalem is a variation on that character. It's the Warren Ellis...
Avatar?
Yeah, he'd deny it, but it's like, dude, when the same type of character who's a chain-smoking British angry shouty person keeps showing up, I'm thinking it's you.
Yeah, it's so obviously a cliche of his, and because, I don't know, I guess the Diodato post-image style doesn't help because it just makes everything, like, super dramatic. It just seems like such an embarrassing cliche. However, I didn't hate World Engine. I thought it had some vigor to it. It was certainly passionate, and it tried to do something different. I think the end of the arc, which ends with Thor reenacting the ending of Superman 1 by turning back time, seemed a little...
He didn't really turn back time. He just...
He did.
Well, no.
He says he's turning back time.
No, he worked against the aging of the world tree. That's different than... No actual time travel existed. He just de-aged the attempt to start the apocalypse.
And then when the Warren Ellis avatar character just gets dismissed off-panel...
that was him just disappearing from the comic.
Yeah.
He's like, all right, I showed up, I did this. Take it from here, Marvel and William Messner Loebs. Hey...
Have you
read that? Now, tell me that Matt Fraction's version of Odin is not just Warren Ellis' version of Odin.
No, I think Warren Ellis' version of Odin goes farther.
As much of a
jerk as Matt Fraction's Odin is, this Odin is unbelievable. I like this Odin more, because he's just a complete dick.
Well, that's what I'm saying. Like, I'm just saying, like, Matt Fraction is definitely... Like, he's not taking it as far as Ellis did, but it's definitely drawing on Ellis's Odin as just the biggest jackass, mean, spiteful old man ever.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah, I do like this more than Jonathan Hickman's Ultimate Thor.
Oh, you read that?
I read that, which, by the way, looks great. Carlos Pacheco inked by Dexter Vines. Anybody inked by Dexter Vines looks 100 times better than they normally do. Dexter Vine brings out the best in everybody, and Carlos Pacheco is no exception. It looks good. However, there's not much to it. It doesn't have much to it.
Well, especially that final issue. That final issue was such a disappointment in the sense that it's like, and here's your prologue to the Ultimates. It
right.
didn't even seem like the other stories he'd started really ended.
Right.
It's just sort of like, oh, and now this happens, and I guess there's a big flash in.
And then here's the midichlorian explanation of how Thor got his hammer.
Yeah. I really liked how Donald Blake turned out to be Balder, though.
Yes.
I also liked the way, when you're talking about Carlos Pacheco, I loved the way that Carlos Pacheco totally, when it turned into Balder, was totally drawn Kirby style for that face.
Mm. Yeah. That's interesting. No, I was, I wouldn't say I was disappointed by Ultima Thor, but I was certainly underwhelmed. And World Engine I thought was a complete visual mess, but it was an engaging story. I thought it was far more entertaining than Ultimate Thor. I also bought a couple other Thor books that I haven't read. I bought the Robert Rohde Thor stuff, and my son read the one with Loki. It was just the Loki miniseries, but it's called something else in collected edition.
Oh, I don't know.
It's called Thor and Loki, but it's the Loki miniseries, the painted one by Ribic or whatever his name is.
Yeah.
And then I bought the one drawn by Simone Bianchi.
Oh, Thor for Asgard.
Yeah, and my son read both of those, and he said those were both terrible. So
yeah, for Asgard, it's the first issue showed so much promise. It had a nice, dark mood. Like, this felt like Ragnarok was coming, everybody's going to die kind of thing. And then it just sort of went nowhere.
So anyway, I went on a Thor binge, and that's what I read. And honestly, World Engine was the best out of all of them, even though it looks terrible.
I don't think it looks terrible.
Oh, it does.
I think it has its problems, but...
No, it's a god-awful looking book. It doesn't look that much different from... It doesn't look much different from Youngblood. It just doesn't. It looks like it's using Youngblood page layouts with just slightly better rendering.
I don't know. Maybe it was just to hit me at the right time, so I can't see what the art really looks like anymore.
I do appreciate that it uses a larger font for the lettering, because that's one of the problems I have with Ultimate Thor. The font is tiny. It's got all this tiny font all over it, and it's physically annoying to read, whereas World Engine, it's like it's the right size font. It's pleasant. It doesn't annoy me. That's that. So those are some old-timey comics I read.
Cool.
In my non-comic reading thing. The big thing of the week, obviously, was Flashpoint number one, which you did not read.
No, it got stuck in my file, but I think that's only because my shops, like many shops, I imagine, like if you have like one of the event book type things in your file, like I put Flashpoint, the Batman one, and the Secret Seven. Like the same way that last week, when I got Fear Itself number two, I also had whatever, like the Frontline and the Spider-Man miniseries that also came out that week, and I said to him, like, yeah, I just wanted the main book, and he's like, yeah, you're right, sorry, my bad. Like, I think it was just one of those things where he just sort of saw the word or whatever.
Yeah.
So it was in my file, and I put it back.
I think you would not have hated the first issue.
I don't think I would have hated it either. It's that I don't care when it's written by Geoff Johns. He's had enough chances for me to win me over with concepts that seemed kind of okay, and he hasn't, so I see no reason to spend my money on his comics anymore.
It does that thing it's a very handy technique. Well, I don't even know, it's not even a technique, it's a handy excuse, which is, because it's an alternate universe, and I think, knowing you, it's the kind of alternate universe story that you might be into, but barring that, what it's able to do is, because sometimes Geoff Johns, especially when he's introducing characters or concepts, his dialogue can be very on the nose and very cheesy. There's no doubt about it. I happen to enjoy that most of the time, as long as it's not dull. I don't mind that it's overblown dialogue. I don't mind that it's kind of corny. But it somehow works better when it's an alternate universe, because you're in this Flashpoint universe, and it's supposed to be a cheesier version of the regular DCU. Like, that's just how it's set up. You know, Aquaman and Wonder Woman have taken over Europe, and it's like everything is just overblown and exaggerated. And so when characters talk in that heightened, exaggerated, kind of extra goofy style, it fits the tone of the comic very well. And in fact, I think Flashpoint's a lot... the first issue is a lot better than Fear Itself. As in, four or five times better.
Hmm.
It's not saying it's a great comic either. It's just, it's not saying, I did like Fear Itself number one a decent amount, but Flashpoint is more successful at being what it is and embracing its concept, And yet, it also feels completely like a DC event. And I guess I'm just trying to figure out what exactly about it makes it feel so much like a DC event and so different from a Marvel event. And I don't know exactly what that would be. Maybe it's just because it focuses more on the internal continuity and the internal concepts, and it doesn't try to have any kind of relevance to anything in real life at all.
Hmm. Yeah, I don't know. I don't know. For some reason, the reveal that the Batman in this universe is Thomas Wayne, that just bugs me. In that way that I mentioned on Twitter that alternate reality stories are always convenient like that, where things that logically wouldn't happen. Like, the way history was changed was like 100 years ago, this happened instead of that. It's like, okay, all the people that you normally think would have been born, they wouldn't have been born.
Yeah, what about the butterfly effect? The butterfly effect is always the huge explanation they use. Except in alternate universes, when everything basically turns out the same, but slightly different.
Yeah, it's like, I'm sorry, like, you change a person, like, you change, like, my parents' life before I was conceived by, like, even 2 seconds?
Yes.
I wouldn't have been conceived, because that sperm would not have hit when it hit.
Yeah.
Like, that's just that's just how it is. Like, it's so precise on events leading to one to the next, especially, like, with stuff like conception, that you change any of it off by a slight little bit, a couple seconds, like, it's just changed.
Yeah.
But it's just more like, wow, isn't that convenient that they were both inspired to become Batman? Like, how does that work exactly?
Well, the mansion was built over a giant bat cave.
That's true.
Don't forget.
It just seems odd.
Thomas Lane also wore a bat costume before Batman became Batman.
Oh, come on. That was retroactively just put in because they're like, let's have him have a costume.
Are you saying that didn't happen?
No, it happened. I'm just saying it's kind of dumb.
I don't think I don't think you can apply. You can't apply any logic to alternate realities.
I know.
And I like. I mean, we do. You know, nothing has been done with the Thomas Wayne character. He's just a costume, and a grimace. That's all he is, and that's all that he's done in the first issue is look menacing, and then Barry Allen realizes that it's Thomas Wayne. But I do think that in this first issue, Geoff Johns set up enough different versions of familiar DCU things to keep it fresh. And then did you see that new announcement where Flashpoint 5 is going to be the only DC comic released at the end of August that week?
That's totally ripping off my idea for my big DC event, which would have had, for the tenure of that event, it was going to be the only DC comic. Because it was going to so radically change things that you just have to make that the central focus and lose tons of money.
Yeah, they ripped up your idea. And also, you think that's going to happen? Knowing DC and their history with event books and their history with anything, do you honestly think that's somehow going to be the only book shipping that week? Or even if it does, that it won't be delayed into a different week or something? Like, I cannot believe that they have their shipping schedule act together enough where it will all work perfectly and that on that one week, Flashpoint 5 will be the only comic ready to come out, and they're holding off on everything else. It seems like it's so unlikely.
I think they'll pull that off, but even if, like, books are going to get pushed back, they just won't release them that week. Like, if anything else, I think they'll only be shooting for Flashpoint number 5 to be ready, and any of the Flashpoint other books to be out before that. And then anything else that would be delayed, like, from the previous week to the 31st, they'll just not release that week and hold off till the next week. Because I don't think that's that hard to say, like, oh, schedule-wise, we'd have to ship this on the 31st, or we could just hold it back another week. Like, you can hold stuff back pretty easily.
It's actually, it's this giant rope-a-dope with the retailers, or 1-2 knockout punch, where, hey, retailers, in June, you're getting 22 Flashpoint titles. And then in this week in August, you're getting one DC comic. So
here's the question.
I hope average retailer, that you're fine with making $6 off the DC comic line total that week.
Yeah, but they think everybody will buy it because everybody has to buy a DC book every week. Actually, other people, like, people have to buy DC books.
Okay, we know that's not going to happen, but even if they're thinking it's going to happen, that would require retailers to order the triple the amount, so they're risking even more, and if it doesn't happen, then they're triply screwed.
My real question is, will any trade paperbacks or collections or non-DCU but DC titles come out that week?
I'm sure they will.
Because if those come out, they have to... No, if you're going to do it, you make sure you have nothing else come out.
Vertigo,
no kids, no collections, nothing. It's just one item for the DC releases that week on Diamond's, like, list.
Yeah.
Just Flashpoint 5. Nothing else. If anything else would show up in that list, you don't release it. Otherwise, it's lost amongst the sea of Vertigo. Actually, that could be, like, the best thing that ever happened for Vertigo. So if you're listening to people in charge of Vertigo, try to arrange it so all your books accidentally get released that week and pick up the slack for the DCU. And it's like, wow, look at that. Their sales increased. Probably not.
It is also a thing where, I mean, I don't think there's anything wrong with the approach, except from a retailer point of view. It's screwing with the retailers, but... It certainly does focus attention, but it also relies on the fact that readers would actually buy into the fact that this one issue will change everything. And how can they, maybe they will, in a single issue of an alternate reality comic book series, change that much? I mean, wouldn't the change happen later? Wouldn't the change be proven by what happens post-Flashpoint, even if they set up the change? Because they've done a lot of things in a lot of series where they set up a change that was never followed up on. So how are they going to say definitively, in this issue, things change forever, and here's how we're going to prove that it's going to change? I don't understand that.
How are they going to do that when we're going to see the September solicitations?
Yeah.
That's the thing. Unless you're willing to say, like, to then to prove that you're changing... to not release any solicitations. Not even like, here's the numbers classified. It's just, we're not releasing any solicitations until this issue comes out. And by that, then the only way to do that is to basically say we're not releasing any comics in September. Because you can get away with holding back stuff for October, probably, until that issue comes out. That's still kind of a crunch period, but at least it'd be before final order cutoff dates.
Mm-hmm.
So they basically, if they really wanted to pull some surprises, they'd basically have to release that, not have anything in September, and then have the big stuff start happening in October, which they reveal on August 31st.
Yeah,
actually, they'd almost have to hold everything back until September 1st, just to let like Flashpoint number 5 hang in the air a little bit.
Yeah.
Because that's something always kind of annoying me when Marvel did that, where it's like, all right, here's your free thing of the previous thing that you're more inclined to possibly flip through while you're, like, waiting for them to ring you up before you read the comic that reveals all the big changes.
Right.
So they kind of almost need to wait until, like, the day after to reveal anything about what's happening after.
Which they can't do because you have to have an informed order.
That's true. That's the thing, is that... the way the business is set up, you're very limited in what you're allowed to do, unless you're just willing to go, screw it. Screw the surprise. We're just doing it anyways.
So that's one of the... I don't know that the switch to digital will ever really happen, to be honest, because I don't know. We've talked about digital comics in the past, but if the switch to digital did happen, and if comic shops did just disappear, and there was no more direct market, maybe there were comic shops, but they were like used bookstores, and they weren't direct market vendors anymore. You could do that. You could have a series that had this major twist and then let the readers buy it later. It doesn't matter. They can buy it at any time. You know, people can jump on the bandwagon a couple days later and download like crazy. So if it's actual sales as opposed to guesstimates on what people might buy, then you can have actual twists and turns and you never have to spoil it for anybody.
That's true.
That would be a huge advantage if everything was just purely digital. You didn't have to worry about the direct market.
You pointed out one advantage that I totally agree with.
Well, the other advantage is the convenience, too. Not everybody's near a comic book shop. The disadvantage is The big disadvantage is that you don't own the stuff. That's a big disadvantage. Yeah, if you owned the stuff, even in digital form, I think I would be more inclined to jump in that direction.
I'd be slightly more inclined. I think still the big disadvantage for me is that I just like physical copies.
Yeah, me too. But that's just a habit, more so.
Yeah.
Than
but I'm okay with that habit. I see nothing wrong with that habit. Well, I mean, actually, there's stuff wrong with it, but I'm okay with the habit nonetheless.
Yeah, I'm okay with it, too. All right, Flashpoint. We're done talking about that. You should buy it, eventually. Maybe not. Don't buy it. Oh, here's what I'm thinking, though. As I was flipping through it just a minute ago, I guess the big difference between Marvel and DC events, and the reason this feels like a DC event, is that what DC does well, when it does stuff well, DC does spectacle very well. And recently, Marvel, over the past 10 years, has been... And historically, Marvel's been more character-centric. So when you have an event and you're trying to put the character stuff in there, it doesn't work well. But if you're just doing an event that's pure spectacle, it can be mindless spectacle and it can feel appropriate. And I think that's the problem with so many of the Marvel events that have faltered a little bit, is that they try to do some character stuff and that cuts away from the event time, the spectacle time. Whereas in Flashpoint, there's a little bit of character stuff with Barry Allen in the alternate reality, and he's like, oh, my life is totally upside down. But then it's basically boom, boom, boom. There's all these new characters introduced, and they all get their one or two sentences to kind of explain their deal. And that's cool for a first issue of an event book because it sets a new stage. And then you say, oh, how is all this going to play out? In Marvel books, you don't always get that. You get, oh, let's look at it from the character's point of view. Look, people on Earth are fighting because Asgard was destroyed and they need jobs, so let's give them jobs to build Asgard. Or I don't even really know what that was about, to be honest.
See, what I want to see is the Flashpoint Aftermath one-shot featuring Cyborg, where he remembers everything and kills himself because in that universe, he mattered.
Right.
He's like, man.
People liked him.
Well, that's the thing that, like... That's another thing with alternate reality things, when they have characters remember what happened. Like, the one that still bugs me is Peter Parker remembering House of M.
Because
I'm sorry, like...
Again, I don't think he remembers that anymore, does he?
I don't know. I don't know what they did with that.
I think that was part of... was One More Day was getting rid of that stuff, too.
Oh, did they get rid of that? But I mean,
I think so. I don't think he remembers that
like,
anymore.
They hinted at how screwed up that would make him.
Yeah.
But I think that's one of those things, like... That would just screw up his life forever if you remember that world.
But that is the entire plot of the Ms. Marvel series, was that she knew she was a great hero in this alternate reality, and she knows she's a screw-up in this reality, and she's trying to make an effort to be better.
Yeah, which works, like, that it can work to inspire someone, but I think in Peter Parker's case, that would have just driven him to, like, lonely drinking and a horrible suicide.
You have a very different version of Peter Parker than I do.
I don't know, getting your heart's desire of marrying Gwen Stacy, having the family, being a big star, then losing that all to go back to his same crappy life. Like, that's like Matt Murdock level of suffering.
I don't know the physical effects of alternate realities, but I'm not sure that after a while that feels like anything more than just a dream. Even though you experienced it, like you can experience things in your dream, and if you wake up from a dream where you had all that stuff happen to you and you had this perfect alternate life, I don't think you spend the next week like wallowing in self-pity because of a dream you had.
Yeah, but that's the thing. I always get the impression that alternate realities, if you remember that, that's like memories. That's like two versions of like the same day kind of memories that right there would kind of make you kind of crazy. Because you'd have two entire histories up until that point of memories. So right there, that would kind of screw you up.
Hmm.
That's something that's never been, like... And it's not just that. Like, that was just an example I'm using because of comics. But, like, did you watch Star Trek Next Generation?
No. Five episodes total.
There was one episode where there's this weird alien probe that scans the Enterprise and, like, creates, like, some sort of telepathic link with Picard, where the whole thing about it was some society that had, like, their son was going to die. So they loaded up all these memories of, like, this one guy to sort of preserve their society. So he lives this guy's life. And then once, at the end of the program, then he returns, and it's only been, like, 20 minutes in the real world, but he's lived, like, this one guy's entire life, and he remembers it all. And I'm thinking, like, wow, that would just mess you up. Like, I don't think you could go back to leading your old life at all after an experience like that.
See, I have a totally different view of memory, because I think the reason that painful memories are eventually just memories is that your body is designed to kind of let that stuff go. And so if you were in that situation where you had a significant experience in an alternate reality or whatever, or just like a significant traumatic event of any sort, you eventually deal with it. Your brain deals with it.
Yeah, but I'm not sure the brain is capable, especially, we're talking years of memory here. Like, that's a lot for your brain to suddenly just set aside. Like,
true.
We're not talking about, like, one or two painful events. We're talking decades of memories that, like, you can't just put that aside. And if you could, it would take years to get over that, I think.
Well, that would probably screw you up then.
That's what I'm saying. And I know why they can't ever show that, because we're talking about serialized fiction where things tend to stay the exact same.
But also, almost every experience these characters have would cause post-traumatic stress disorder. And you can't just have them acting like that all the time.
You can if it's martial law.
You could. But, I mean, even the Spider-Man example, like him being married and having a perfect life with Gwen Stacy in alternate reality, is that significantly more traumatic than his experiences in outer space for the first time, or knowing Galactus is walking around New York City? There are so many things he's experienced that would completely traumatize anyone who had to deal with any sense of reality that I don't think the alternate universe even makes a dent on that.
That's true. By this point, he should just be completely crazy. I think that's actually how I'd do Spider-Man the End, is that all of this is, most of his history is just the weird, crazy fantasies he's had after he lost his mind after being Spider-Man for all of 6 months.
After what he experienced within just the Ditko issues.
Yeah, he like, the first 6 months of his Spider-Man crew would probably be enough to drive him a little bit crazy.
Actually, that would be a good justification. So the Ditko stuff was the only stuff that really happened. And then the Romita years were his psyche's attempt to glorify the horrible life he had, and that's why everybody starts looking more attractive and he starts getting more popular. And that's all his deep psychosis. But even within that Romita sheen, there are cracks that begin to form, and then with the death of Gwen Stacy, everything just falls downhill. And like, look what happened to the poor guy after Gwen Stacy died. Like, it's been time after time, just horrible events that have happened to him.
Yeah.
So yeah, it all takes place inside his mind.
Yeah. I mean, let's be honest. If you looked at a lot of comic book characters, it is a wonder they have not all just jumped off a bridge.
Yeah, that's why you can't bring realism to comics, because it is dumb and doesn't make sense. Except in parody. You can only do it as a parody.
Yeah. Well, I mean, like, ultimately, like, well, that's the thing, like, I wondered with Tony Stark and his alcoholism and how someone's going to eventually cause him to start drinking again. But after what Marvel put him through in the past few years, like, what are they going to come up with? And then I think we decided that it would probably be something very small that just causes it rather than some big, horrible thing.
Yeah.
But it's just like, they heap so much, especially like him, Matt Murdock, too. Like, Matt Murdock would have killed himself. I'm sorry. That guy would have killed himself years ago. Like, his life has just been so god-awful that there's no way he would have put up with it. Or he would have just, like, he would have left and he would have stayed away for good. Like, there's no way you keep living your life the same way when things are that bad.
The thing is, Daredevil's never really had the up moments. You know, he's had mediocrity, he's had struggles, he's had long bouts of pain and suffering, But he's never had those big moments when he's a big popular hero in New York City and everybody loves him. Like, that's never been who he is. Other characters in the Marvel Universe have had, you know, other major characters have had their ups and downs. Daredevil's had just a lot of loneliness and misunderstanding.
That's a good argument. He wouldn't actually be... It doesn't hit him as hard because his life's been crappy since birth anyways.
Yeah. He's like Droopy the dog of the Marvel Universe.
Yeah. I mean, Batman hasn't killed himself because, as Grant Morrison has explained, his superpower is that he thrives on horribleness in his life. The more pain and suffering he experiences, the stronger he gets. Superman hasn't gone through anything that bad, really. He's gone through some bad stuff, but...
I will say that Daredevil Reborn, for the good of the art, David Kean Felice, however you pronounce his name.
Yeah, I know he...
As nice as that art is with the Matt Hollingworth colors, Daredevil Reborn is the lamest example that from recent memory of that thing where, hey, let's put the hero to the side a little bit so that we can bring him back refreshed. Because the entirety of Daredevil Reborn was like an episode of the original TV show The Fugitive. That's it. It was like Daredevil's out in a town where he doesn't know anybody, and he gets caught up in this little local crime thing, and he's got to help a young boy. And then at the end, he learns the true meaning of Christmas or something. And then he's going to go back to New York now. Or he ends up in New York at the end and sees Foggy, and Foggy's far thinner than he was when he left. That's the entire plot of the story, and it's just so hollow and so TV episode feeling. It's not a good Daredevil story, and it's not a good redemption story. It's pathetic and limp and embarrassing, and I can't believe that was the big Daredevil Reborn.
Okay, how about this? This just occurred to me. Matt Murdock would not have killed himself. Foggy would have shot that guy by now.
Seriously. Why is Foggy happy to see him? Foggy used to be the district attorney of New York City.
And that's a big deal.
That's a huge deal. They never talk about it. Because Foggy's life has been an embarrassment since then.
Yeah, Foggy would have killed that guy by now.
Oh, Foggy. So, I don't recommend Daredevil Reborn, even though it does look okay.
Well, that's a question almost that I have to wonder, because from what little I've read of his writing, he hasn't impressed me, but Andy Diggle, is he actually a good writer or not? People seem to think he's a really good writer until they actually talk about the comics he's written. Then they're kind of like, yeah, he's not that good. But they seem to insist he's a good writer. Almost the same way that they do with Mike Carey, who I think is a good writer at times and a bad writer at others. But they'll always just be like, this isn't too good. But, you know, he's a good writer. And it's like, is he? Because you seem to think he sucks most of the time.
I thought there were a couple issues of Andy Diggle's Daredevil run, the ones drawn by Roberto De La Torre, that were decent, that were pretty good. But other than that, I've never read an Andy Diggle series that I loved. I didn't think his Green Arrow Year One was any good. I didn't think The Losers was any good. People love The Losers.
I haven't read The Losers.
People love it. It's okay. It's, I don't know, maybe I didn't give it enough of a chance. I read the first arc, I read the first six issues.
Maybe
it got better.
His Hellblazer had the odd good moment, but the ending of it, oh my god, I'm surprised he hasn't been, like, punched in the face by Hellblazer fans for that horrible shit of an ending. Where it's like, oh wait, John Constantine's not a fuck-up because he's just a fuck-up, it's because his good self was dragging him down so it could take over his body and lead the world into paradise. It's like, fuck off! Don't explain away his horrible behavior on some other influence. His horrible behavior because he's a horrible person, ultimately. It was one of those just weird continuity, retroactive bullshit things that I'm surprised they let him do. And I hope everybody ignores.
The thing about Andy Diggle, and he might be a good writer, but I'm just not reading the right stuff by him. I don't know. He seems capable of being a good writer. I mean, he doesn't write characters who speak in cliche or anything. He doesn't necessarily tell plots that are obvious. But here's what I see as the failing, or the reason that I can't ever get engaged in an Andy Diggle comic. I'm like, I'll read it, I'll be like, yep, that happened. It's because it seems like he sets his characters down this course, and then he has them go down that course. And even if there are plot twists along the way, like, everything just seems so inevitable and so by the numbers at that point. I don't like the term by the numbers, but there's no aesthetic surprise. There's nothing in the way it's told that gives it any kind of verb or life or energy. It just seems like he set up these structures, and then he's having the characters inhabit these structures, these storytelling structures, and then it's the end. And that's all I get from him. It's a little different than Mike Carey. I'd put him in the same level as Mike Carey. Mike Carey, for me, his comics just, the tempo of his comics just always seem wrong. It's not about the lack of style. It's about just that the pacing always seems off, and I can't get into the rhythm of his writing for some reason.
I don't know what you mean about that. Yeah, Mike Carey, he is very hit or miss with me. Like, even like his Hellblazer run, which when I reread last year, on the overall, I enjoyed it. I thought it was a really good run. I thought, like, it was about the best type of run you're going to get from someone who's, like, obviously a big fan of the character and his history.
Mm-hmm.
And the way that he wove in stuff that called back to things and did new things. Like, it was definitely a fan run, and probably one of the better fan runs you're ever going to see on a book, because fans tend to suck at writing characters that you like. But even then, like, it was maybe successful 60 to 70% of the time, which, you know, kicks the crap out of the majority of comic book writers, let's be honest. But still isn't, like, spectacular. Like, but I just noticed that, especially when Kelly and I were doing the Age of X dialogues, she would even say that, like, yeah, but he's, you know, a good writer, as, you know, talking about how the first half of that story arc was really good, and the second half was really bad. And it's like, what you've basically described, you haven't described a good writer, you've described an average writer who hits his mark half of the time.
Yeah, I think there's a difference with someone like that and Bendis, who Bendis has trouble ending stories, mm-hmm. but that's because he's just not a strong plotter. And he focuses so much on the character work that the plots always fall by the wayside. And unless you have the strong plot mechanism to pull things out at the end, your stories are going to have anticlimactic conclusions.
It's also because he's always focused on what's going to happen next. So his endings are always, at the same time, prologues to next time.
Yeah, he builds up that machinery of
never-ending
climax, yeah.
Yeah, he's too into serialization that he always knows, like, he's writing so far ahead, it's like, he knows when he finishes this issue, he's got another issue he's going to write tomorrow.
Mm.
And he just sees it all as one big thing. Even if there's story arcs, it's still one big story to him kind of thing, so.
Right. And the one project that's been the longest in the works is that Daredevil The End. So the story that he's going to write the ending to is the one that has never come out yet. Because everything else is just second act. Always act two. Yeah. Hey, so you read Journey into Mystery, right?
I did.
Graham McMillan pointed this out. I kind of knew it, but I didn't think about it. So in Fear Itself, the entire first issue features the fact that Asgard has been destroyed and is now in ruins on Earth, and then Tony Stark is going to hire people. He's going to reinvigorate the economy by hiring humans to rebuild Asgard.
The city of Asgard, yes.
But then at the end of the issue, the Asgardians...
Yeah, I know where you're going with this already, and I know how to respond to it.
The Asgardians go back to Asgard.
That's because that space... That's like... Say...
And then, hang on, in this Journey into Mystery issue, he says he forged a new Asgard from the very air itself. And so he rebuilds the city of Asgard back on the Asgardian plane.
Yeah,
That's sort of explained in this Journey to Mystery issue. But it's not that I don't understand how that works metaphysically. It's that wouldn't you be pissed off as a human if you spent any of your time rebuilding an Asgard that's not really the Asgard? Like, you're not even... What was the point of all that hard labor to rebuild a city that isn't really the city of Asgard after all?
Yeah, I don't think humans quite realize that.
It does seem like all of their work will be futile and make them pissed off when they find out.
Oh, they're not doing it now anyways, because obviously if the Asgardians leave, why would you rebuild
There's nothing to build, yeah.
Yeah, but I mean, like, that never became a concern, because it was, like, obviously Thor being nice to his buddies. And Odin was like, screw those humans. We're going to kill them all anyways.
Yeah.
But yeah, I made... Like, even when it happened... I didn't even need, like, the explanation in Journey into Mystery. I understood exactly what was going on when it happened in Fear itself. Just because... That space still existed. Just because Thor brought the city to Earth doesn't mean that Asgardian, that realm of existence, disappeared.
Right.
And Odin is really powerful. If he wants to just show up and be like... Asgard come back, he can do that.
Yeah, it just makes the entire premise that Tony Stark would actually hire people to rebuild the city extra foolish.
Yeah, that was kind of stupid to begin with anyways, but it was obviously Thor and his pro trying to help humanity kind of thing, throwing everybody a bone.
Right.
It never seemed like, I don't think Tony Stark necessarily thought about it that way, or anybody who would have worked on it thought about it that way.
Yeah.
But that was obviously the truth of what was going on right from the beginning. No, the Asgardians don't need humans to build them a new Asgard.
Right. I mean, I know that, but I'm just... The fact that they don't even pretend to need it at all.
No, because...
They're Asgardians.
Yeah. Although, everything that keeps happening, it keeps making... Matt Fraction has not just... I mean, Gillen here has kind of justified bringing back Loki.
Mm-hmm.
But Fraction has really not justified bringing back Odin other than as a foil to Thor. But why would Thor bring the guy back?
Yeah. I don't think... I'm not interested in the justification, because I think that's the Kurt Busification of comics. I don't need the justifications. But
I need justifications when characters do inexplicable things.
Okay. Here's what I need. Is it completely ridiculous and doesn't serve the story? If so, well, that's dumb then. Is it interesting? Then I'm willing to give it a pass. If it's interesting, I don't really care. And I think having Odin around is far more interesting than not having Odin around. And
yeah,
I think having a young Loki is at least something a little bit different, especially after we've been kind of Loki'd out up through and including Siege.
Yeah, the Odin thing, though, that just reminds me of your big complaint about Andy Diggle, though. It's like, it's the thing that I kept saying about most of the stuff that happened in that World Eaters arc on Thor. It all happens because the script says it's supposed to happen.
Mm, yeah.
It's just, this is the story that's being told. Never mind it actually making sense or featuring any character motivation that...
Yeah, but at least Odin does stuff that creates a tension and a conflict that is interesting. So it's not just, oh, you're watching this unfold. It's like, oh, well, here's a little spectacle going on, which I appreciate. I think Journey into Mystery is pretty good. The first
two. Yeah, no, it's good.
I've quite enjoyed, and I don't even hate the art, even though I don't love Doug Braithwaite's art usually. The way that this is colored gives it a weird kind of almost, I don't know, it's like a weird alternative comics version of coloring over pencil work.
Yeah, it really works, because it looks like... Honestly, it's the way that I always like to see colors over pencils, in the sense that it looks like the way you drew stuff as a kid, in the sense that you drew it in pencil, then you used pencil crayons to color it.
Yeah.
Like, it has a pencil crayon coloring look to it, so it's like it was drawn all in pencils.
And even that, there's that page where Thor's in prison and Loki's underneath the grate in the prison floor. That two-page sequence, Thor looks pretty raw. Not just in terms of he's been beat up, which he has been, but those aren't particularly good drawings of Thor. But I like that. It makes the whole thing seem kind of odd and unsettling, and it makes it look a little bit more lively than the polished artwork that you tend to see.
I agree. I'm digging Journey into Mystery.
Now, you haven't read... You're not reading Gillen's X-Men, are you?
No.
I think... Man, the first two issues that he's taken over as a solo writer, they're strong, and they seem to have a very clear direction. And he's doing this thing where he's combining the best of Morrison with the best of Joss Whedon, and he's so clearly trying to do that, but it's pretty fun to see him pull those things together into a way that's an exciting story. So I have certainly... It doesn't hurt that Greg Land hasn't drawn any of his issues yet. So that's a bonus.
Here's the thing, though. He will.
I know.
He will.
Oh, jeez. Yeah. Oh, hey, one more thing before we get into probably talking about other comics. I would like to point out that if anybody's looking for a random single issue of a comic, iZombie 12, which came out last month, but it's the one drawn by Gilbert Hernandez, I think that is a great single issue. It doesn't, I mean, it's the origin of one of the characters, kind of, but Gilbert Hernandez draws in several different styles throughout the issue, and it's a great single issue of a comic. It's a great Vertigo one-off issue, and if you find it in a discount bin somewhere, iZombie number 12, it's the one iZombie issue to get if you're only going to get one. It's cool looking. It's a cool looking comic.
Cool.
And that's saying something, considering it's always drawn by Mike Allred, who's pretty darn great.
Yeah, but there are plenty of other Mike Allred comics to buy.
That's the thing. There's plenty of Gilbert Hernandez comics to buy, too, honestly. But this one, he's doing so many different styles within the issue, and it's a complete story in and of itself. Yeah, I'm surprised that there hasn't been more writing about this single issue. I would think that in other times, I don't know. I think a lot of the people that we read are either turned off by comics right now, or they're fascinated on like some little corner of the comic book world. But in normal times, a whole bunch of people would have written about iZombie number 12. That would have happened. I just read it this week, so I'm behind on the curve.
Yeah, I haven't read it, but from a conceptual thing, even it happening, like I remember seeing a few people just comment that, hey, this is happening. But even then, it didn't really seem to get a lot of buzz going around it.
Yeah, and honestly, the issue is so good that if I were to do a mid-year best of list, this single issue of iZombie would easily make my top 10 for the year. Maybe even my top 5 for the year. And I've read a lot of comics this year. That's what I'm saying.
Oh yeah, this week, totally pre-ordered through my shop that Incal hardcover that's not quite as deluxe as the first one.
Well, I've got the deluxe version that doesn't fit on my shelf, so I win. I paid more than you. How much is this other deluxe edition?
$45.
Yeah, that's a lot less than $100.
I'll trade you.
Maybe. Maybe I will.
I'll trade you.
How big is this new edition?
It's like regular size, like... Probably, I think it's probably going to be like the same sort of dimensions as like Weapons of the Meta Barons kind of thing.
Yeah, I'll keep my giant oversized version then.
Yeah, this one would fit on your shelf though.
That's all right. I'll buy new shelves. I'll build a special shelf just for this.
Well, that's the thing. If you build a new shelf, you should just use Wednesday Comics as the measuring point, because I don't think you can get many that are taller than that one.
Except Kramer's Urgot.
Is it taller than
that? Oh yeah, it's almost 50% bigger.
Really?
Yeah, it's enormous.
Wow, I've never seen that one. So, like the tallest one I've ever seen that I can think of in a store has been Wednesday Comics, that hardcover.
Yeah, no, Kramer's are gotten bigger.
Okay, so you have another one to use as your measuring point. Couldn't you just like take? I guess no. If you built shelves, you wouldn't want to take out a shelf to fit the big ones.
No. It should get a special display case, actually, so you can see more than just the spine. You can see the front cover showing.
Display case. And I say this with the confidence that nobody.
Are you playing with the microphone?
Oh, I had to rub my eyes, so I had to move the
microphone. Oh, I just heard a lot of scratching.
Yeah, sorry about that, folks. something in my eye.
Yeah, sorry that the audio quality is not up to our usual high standards.
Well, right now, I'm hopefully going to win a nice deluxe Absolute Dark Knight on eBay that I hope... Nobody will get this far in the podcast because the auction ends in, like, 6 hours. So by the time it's posted, they'd have to... I guess it's not that hard to find it, but it's at a really good price right now.
Yeah.
Let's see. Surprisingly, I don't know how this person's getting away with doing this, but they're only charging $10 shipping to Canada for an Absolute Edition. I'm sorry, it's going to cost you more than that, guy.
How much are you bidding on it for right now?
Right now, I'm winning at the maximum bid of $27.
Yeah, you're not going to get it for that price. I bet it'll go for 50 total, 52.
I don't know, 6 hours left. Ending in the middle of the night's not always a good thing, but... It'll
go for 50-something.
My maximum bid right now is 30.
Yeah, because people just put it on their watch list and then bid in the last 5 minutes, so...
Maybe. We'll see what happens when I wake up tomorrow morning.
The cheapest on Amazon used is 50, so it'll definitely go for that much.
Yeah, you never know.
You never know.
I've won auctions that I was surprised that I won for really super cheap prices, because people look, but... Not everybody's fanatical about always looking and finding stuff right away. Like, it could be one of those things where the people look would start, like, look again on Sunday and just somehow miss this one auction.
Yeah, although, I don't know. I don't know how I feel about eBay these days, but I know it seems like over the past 5 or 6 years, eBay has been far more stable with that kind of thing, where there's more consistent prices that pop up. I remember... In the earlier days of eBay, I mean, not even the super early days, but like 7 years ago or so, the prices would be so out of whack. And I remember I sold some board game. I don't remember what it was called. And I sold it for like $35, and I was shocked because I was putting stuff up there because I was like, there was no basis of comparison. And then I saw other of the same board games go for like $3.95 or something. So I don't know why mine sold for way more. I just got
rid of it. Oh, you're talking about $3.95. I thought you were talking about $395.
No, like less than $5. And so I don't know why mine sold for a lot more. It didn't make sense.
I'm always amazed where I was looking for, like, there's maybe, like, four Guitar Hero Rock Band-type games for PlayStation 2 that we would want and we don't have. And looking through those listings where it's like, for, like, Guitar Hero was 1 through 3, why anybody on that site ever tries to charge more than $5 is beyond me, because there's, like, 28 people selling each one of those for $5 or less already.
Yeah.
Like, I don't understand the pricing that goes through... I don't understand the pricing of anything that's ever out of print either, where it's like, okay, I understand people are willing to pay a little bit more for something, but I doubt they're willing to pay, like, $100 for a book that was originally $20.
It happens.
Especially, like, certain things like hardcovers or omnibuy or whatever.
Especially because they're probably going to be reprinted.
They may be reprinted, or, honestly, it would be cheaper for me to just go buy the issues. Like,
yeah.
At this point...
But, yes.
At this point, it would honestly probably be cheaper for me to buy all of the Walt Simonson, Thor issues, all of the Daredevil, Frank Miller Daredevil issues. Like, those issues, I've looked, they're not that expensive.
Right, but you're buying the omnibus because you want the better printing quality.
I'm not buying the omnibus of either one. I'm not buying, like, the Simonson omnibus because I don't want that stupid recoloring.
Right, but if you're going to buy it, that's why you're buying it. You're not buying it because you don't own the issues necessarily. You're buying it because you want the better quality. I mean, because you can get the issues for these things.
Well, I know, but I mean, I'm just talking, like... certain examples of stuff like that where I just...
It makes a big difference because I was reading... What was it? I don't even remember. I pulled out a bunch of old issues to read. Oh, no. It's Alpha Flight. So at one point, Sean Witzke and I were going to discuss Alpha Flight, and we might still, but I seriously ran out of steam after about 4 or 5 issues because Alpha Flight is so terrible. But it's physically difficult for me to read some of those early issues because the printing quality is so bad. And I don't know if the ink has degraded over the years or what, but the lettering is like blurry. Hmm. And in a lot of the 80s comics, it's just hard to read. Even something like, even recent comics, Morrison's New X-Men run. Morrison's New X-Men run was still printed on cheap paper.
Was it?
Yeah. Go back and read those first.
I'd have to go back and find wherever my dad has his issues, because I only have...
Check out the printing of those Frank, the first arc, the E for Extinction arc, whatever it's called.
I only have it in hardcover.
Yeah, no, it was cheap paper, and it didn't look good. It's harder to read. You can't see the line work as well. And so, yeah, that's why people buy the collected edition. I mean, that's why I buy these hardcovers and omnibus editions, even for comics I own, because it looks better and it's cleaner to read. I don't like recoloring that changes the coloring scheme.
Yeah, I don't buy many of those if I already own it. Like, the Enco one I'm going to buy, even though I have the DC reprints, but that's because I want to see the original coloring.
Like, I think the Walt Simon omnibus is probably... I might buy it eventually. I don't know. But it's one of the few that I haven't been tempted to buy just because it's even bigger and more unwieldy than other omnibus editions, and yeah. I own the new versions of the trade paperbacks that are very convenient to read.
Yeah, I want to get those. And, like, Wednesday Comics, I eventually want to get that hardcover, but that's because that's especially printed on not paper that's made to last and age well.
Although it's smaller than Wednesday Comics.
It's actually smaller than the newspaper stuff when you unfold it?
Oh, it's like half the size, yeah.
I don't know. When I saw it in the bookstore, it looked pretty damn big.
No, it's half the size. It's the size of it folded. It's not the size of the full spread.
You sure?
I'm positive. I own it.
I don't know. Other people were talking about how big it is. And
it's nowhere near the size of the newsprint. Trust me. It's not a broadsheet.
I'd still get it, though.
No, it's still worth seeing. And it looks great at that size. In that vivid printing. And it's a different experience. But it's not as big. I wish it were as big. That would be amazing. Someday, we'll see a facsimile edition. And hopefully DC will send me a review copy.
Yeah.
I did get guess what I got a review copy of?
I hate you already.
Well, I got Flashpoint number one as a review copy, which I didn't know I got until after I bought Flashpoint number one. I was like, oh, great, now I have to. But
so send me your copy.
Guess what else DC sent to promote this week for a single issue besides Flashpoint number one? Guess what their other big release of the week was?
Well, let me actually go look at their list of what came out this week.
Yeah, make an educated guess by looking at the list. But I still don't think you'll guess properly.
Savage Critics, because that's the easiest way to look, is Brian Hibbs' list.
I found it to be a strange choice from DC.
Well, the minute you say that, it's automatically going to make me like go for something kind of strange.
Yeah.
Okay, I have one possible guess, but I'm still looking to see what
I
have.
All right, let's guess from Chad. For comics released, what was the release date? The 12th or 11th or something?
11th.
Yes, if you want to play along at home, the May 11th, 2011 release date.
Kind of
have to narrow it down to a first issue, so.
I'm going
to
go with Batman Arkham City, then.
Yeah, that's the
only thing. That was the only one that kind of stood out to me as, like, this would be something they'd send out.
They sent. And I was like, really? A comic book that's based on a video game that looks as horrible as this comic book does, with the really goofy Carlos Dianda cartoony version of his art, that's what they sent out for review.
You should have reviewed it for CBR.
I don't even want to read it, Chad. I don't want to read it once, even if I get paid to do it. And I flipped through the rest of the issue to see if it was as bad as the preview they keep throwing in the back of DC Comics.
Oh, God.
It's worse. Those were the better pages.
Ugh.
Yeah, it's just an ugly-looking comic. And it's a video game adaptation.
See, what I'm thinking is I should quit reviewing comic books for CBR and maybe DC will put me on their list. Because that's what worked for you.
It did work for me. Although I haven't been getting much. They've been sending stuff very sparingly lately, so I think they put me on the dear F list.
Or maybe they just have been sending out stuff sparingly in general. But then I guess, did you ever get like that Ahmed and whatever, Aaron and Ahmed book?
I did not.
Okay, Graham got that one.
Exactly. Graham gets stuff I don't get. He's on the gold star list. I'm on the maybe I'll get something eventually list.
Wait, you're on a list.
I am on a list, yes.
I used to be on lists, and then places just stopped sending stuff.
Well, everybody's trying to tighten their belts.
I know.
Yeah.
I will say this as a person who doesn't expect anything, but I was excited to be added to, like, Humanoids for, like, that one time.
Yes.
And then,
yeah, I'll take anything else they want to send us. Bob Silva, send us more stuff. I'll take it.
Like, I wasn't expecting, like, that giant Incal hardcover, because that was, like, limited edition $100
right.
type thing, but...
But it was cool to get the I Am Legion.
Yeah, that was cool. I like that. I enjoyed that for what it was. I found it interesting. I still find that I think the most interesting thing about that is seeing a John Cassidy drawn book that doesn't have a single splash page.
Hmm. Interesting.
Just, like, if I ever really did a serious art thing, I think I'd have to, like, pull that out and put it side by side with Planetary and just pick apart how his art is different in both.
Mm-hmm.
Because, like, just for that alone, and then probably throw in some Astonishing X-Men, because Joss Whedon did the same sort of thing Warren Ellis did, which is just like, okay, let's let this guy go crazy and draw big, Gossam-looking things. Whereas in I Am Legion, there, like, I think the least amount of panels on a page ever was 2 or 3.
Yeah.
And that happened, like, once or twice. Most of the time you're talking, like, 6 to 8 panels per page kind of thing.
Yeah, I will, speaking from experience for someone, this hasn't ever seen the light of day, but I did write a script in collaboration, or for someone, who ended up drawing in a really rather elaborate, detailed style. And as soon as I saw the work he was producing on the first, like, 5 pages of the story I wrote, I said, oh man, I've gotta really open things up and let this guy go free. It is hard to do that. It's hard to balance that out. It's hard to balance the storytelling needs with the need to let an artist have the space to do their thing. It's not an easy accomplishment, which is why so many writers these days get slammed with that decompression label, because you do want these artists to have some space, and you don't want to clutter everything up, and you don't want to overly tell the story through your control of the narrative as a writer. You want the artist to carry their fair share, and they can these days. Most of the artists working in mainstream comics are very good. But it's hard to balance that, because you can only convey so much story information with 3 panels per page.
Do you know who was not a very good artist this week?
Who was that?
Howard Chaykin.
I don't know.
I'm kidding, actually. I liked what he did in New Avengers. I was just saying that.
I like his stuff. And also, I really like how the 50s Captain America is, like, extra goofy looking. He's not quite Captain America, and Howard Chaykin makes him look a bit off.
Actually, have you seen Howard Chaykin draw Captain America recently?
Yes.
His Captain America looks kind of weird in general.
He does, but this guy looks even more weird, so much so that when he first appeared, I was like, oh, Howard Chaykin's just going off the reservation with his Captain America. It looks even worse than normal. I was like, oh, wait, it's the fake Captain America. So it's supposed, even if it's not intended to look abnormal, it works. It's an appropriate look for him.
Hey, I more love his goofy as hell Red Skull.
Yeah, me too.
That is how, like, a crazy-ass Nazi with a skull head would look, all googly-eyed and just always looking kind of like, wow, that is a weird, crazy character.
It does have some good visual gags. Yeah, I like this issue of New Avengers.
I liked it too, though. Jumping to the other artist, when did Lawrence Fishburne become a cop in New York City?
I know. So, come on.
I thought he was a CSI guy in Las Vegas.
Yeah, I saw the Lawrence Fishburne thing too, and I said, oh boy.
I loved how we have, like, one issue of the story arc left, and we still have no idea what either plot has to do with one another.
I hope they don't have anything to do with one another. I hope they're just parallel stories that aren't really parallel.
That would be interesting in the sense that I don't think that'll happen, but I'd be interested more in the sense of them, like, wow, they really just kind of went, like, we have two artists, and instead of, like, doing one small arc and then another small arc, we'll just have them both run at the same time because we can.
Mm. Oh, so speaking of Diodato, in World Engine, Diodato is obviously using photo reference for a couple faces. I mean, because most of his art looks Jim Lee-like, so it's not photo referenced. But then the Warren Ellis analog guy and the old man, the guy who actually created the World Engine.
The cannibal guy.
Both of those guys are obviously photo-referenced, and you can see you could see the amount of detail is radically different from the amount of detail he puts in other characters' faces. But the difference is that they're not recognizable. You know, maybe they're people that Mike Deodato knew personally, or maybe they're photos of people who are not famous celebrities. But he was still using that style back then, even when his style was much more cartoony and imagey. But what's annoying is when he draws people who are famous, when he casts his books. I really, really do not like casting comic books by drawing famous people as the characters. I still don't see how that's even legal anyway.
Yeah, I don't really like that either.
I don't understand why all these people just don't sue for likeness rights violations.
That would be interesting.
They should. They should. We should team them up and create a class action suit so that all these guys will stop drawing that way, so the comics will not be unbearable.
I don't know. I think a lot of famous people then think, if an artist draws me like this enough, maybe I'll get a movie role.
Yeah, they do.
Like Sam Jackson.
Jackson. But not Eminem in Wanted.
Yeah, I don't know what... That'd be an interesting thing to find out what happened behind the scenes there, because, I mean, it's not like Wanted did great things for anybody involved with it.
Yeah.
But I actually think that Eminem probably would have been helped by that.
Yeah, I don't know that it would have hurt anybody.
At least on that fame scale. I think it's more that, I think, since he was super famous, he sort of scaled back and just wants to focus on actually being, like, a rapper again, and not just some guy who's famous.
But I would have also thought that out of all the sort of non-rapping roles he could have played, that kind of role would have been a good role for him.
It might have been okay.
He's the right guy.
We've never discussed Wanted, have we?
No.
Wanted?
I really liked Wanted.
Really?
And then I didn't really like the ending. Yeah, I liked the first half of it a lot.
I don't know. It never really grabbed me.
I thought it was. I thought it was the kind of Mark Miller that's provocative and engaging and throwing a lot of crap against the wall and sees what sticks. And I liked all that. And then there was no plot that came together. And then I didn't mind the ending, the literal FU ending. I didn't mind that. I got the joke. But then ultimately all you're left with is, oh, that's a joke. And it deflates the entire meaning.
Yeah, that's the kind of thing. That it was just the joke, and I never understood like anybody who was actually genuinely angry or in favor of it, in the sense that... Like, I remember reading Brian K. Vaughan's intro to the trade, and him defending it and talking about how brilliant it is, and it's like, wow, that sounds like somebody who's never actually read good fiction.
Mm.
Or good metafiction, or anything like that, that does it already, that does it way better.
Yeah, it certainly wasn't subtle.
Yeah. And even then, like, I don't know, I was turned off by the point where you really realize that it was just, like, anybody who's heard, like, oh, this is just his reworked Secret Society of Supervillains pitch. It's like,
yeah.
Really? Wow, good job on hiding that.
I don't mind that they didn't hide it. I don't know,
that took me out of it, partly, too. But then again, I'm really at the point where I can't take superhero analogs, for the most part, too seriously.
Right.
Unless it's meant to... Like, I can take martial law ones fine, because it is what it is. I could take planetary okay, because even then, that was usually just window dressing for another story. Even Irredeemable I could take, because that was there, but it was using it for a specific point, and then diverging in big ways pretty quickly. Just doing regular, like, wow, you would have done this at DC, but with less swearing, and, like, it would have been the exact same.
That's but he wasn't allowed to do it at DC, so he did it somewhere else, so just pretend it happened at DC if you want to.
Yeah.
I like superhero analogs, honestly.
I don't know, I just got to the point, I think it was just this period that around the time of Planetary and the Authority really becoming popular, I think they just happened so much that it really just turned me off of them. Because it seemed they popped up there for a while in larger numbers than other times.
Well, yeah, it was also the Astro City was going on, too.
Yeah.
And that was the one that really didn't try to make any bones about it. Usually when superhero analogs happened before, they were more used for parody, or they were at least somewhat camouflaged. Astro City's like, nope, I'm just doing straight up analogs and I'm not going to treat it as parody.
That's true. Yeah.
And then so there's a lot of stuff that came out around that time that also started doing that. What I hate is when that happens with novels, and you'll see over the past 10 years more and more superhero novels, not adaptations of DC Comics characters or Marvel Comics characters, but attempts at being literary, and they're just like such sort of shallow archetypes, and it doesn't work ever. Those seem embarrassing. Or even the analogs that you'll get in a TV show that tries to do superheroes, like The Cape.
Yeah, I know what you mean.
It doesn't work. In comics, I don't mind it, though, because in comics it feels like, I don't know, in some way it feels like they're all analogs for each other, and it's just all part of the same universe, various alternate reality versions of each other. That's what I think. So I did read Batman Incorporated.
Who didn't read that?
That's a Grant Morrison comic.
That is a Grant Morrison comic.
What do you think about Chris Burnham on Batman Incorporated?
Oh, that's something I was wondering even as I was reading it.
Me too.
Where I like his art, I think I'd have to see another artist drawing the same comic to really get a good handle on what I think about it, though.
I don't think he's wrong for the comic, and I wouldn't mind if Chris Burnham drew a whole giant run of Batman Incorporated, but I am fascinated by his approach, because Chris Burnham does this thing where his characters are goofy and cartoony, but they're also sleazy. So yeah. He's kind of got that Derek Robertson vibe of the sleaze of stuff. But he also has this glossy sheen somehow. I mean, the characters are literally gritty. Like, there's a lot of line work. But because he draws the eyes big and the smiles big, and he draws Batman with that giant grin, it has that weird, overly saccharine feel to it. It's kind of unsettling in its discordance between the joyfulness of it and the grit and grime to it.
Yeah, Bruce Wayne is just so creepy in this comic.
He really is.
Like, to the point where Morrison's writing Bruce Wayne in a way that he hasn't really been written or portrayed so far, but Burnham on art just takes him in such to the point where, like, this isn't the same character that I've ever seen.
Yeah, I know.
He just comes off as this weird, manic, like, hyperactive person.
Hyper smug, hyper excited. I like it, but it is odd. And I can't help but being hyper aware of it as it's going on. I'm like, this is an odd approach.
I do find it funny that Chris Burnham draws Bruce Wayne's eyebrows so that they look like
the Batman mask, yeah.
Yeah. It's like, oh, look at that. He has a little Batman logo going on his face.
He does. Right. Oh, man. Yeah, it's just it's a weird approach. I mean, I think he's a strong artist. He's certainly unconventional. It does give Batman Incorporated just such a strange, almost bootleg version of itself kind of vibe.
Yeah, it turns it into a weird sort of dark comedy of a comic.
Yes. It really does.
Like, I have the page open where he opens up the back of the truck and you see those manic kids who have killed all those people just shouting Leviathan with these weird grins on their faces. And you're like, Okay, is that supposed to be comedic or what? Like, again, it looks cool, but I would generally want to know what tone Grant Morrison wanted.
Yeah.
Like I said, like that's almost how I wanted. Like I said, like I almost want to see how another artist would have drawn this issue before I can really judge what Burnham did to it entirely.
Right, but just imagine it drawn by Jock or somebody. I mean, because you can, you know, Detective Comics is coming out at the same time, and that exact page drawn by Jock would have a completely different tone. Which is
well, those would have been the creepy little like kids that are like almost with glowing red eyes kind of thing.
Exactly, but here. There are these weird mannequin kids that are look like rugrats, and yet that's horrifying in its own way.
Something that Brian Cronin pointed out that I didn't get when I read it, but did you interpret it the same way that Black Bat is Cassandra Cain?
Yes, that's what I thought.
That didn't occur to me, but then again, I care so little about Cassandra Cain that she doesn't really register in my thoughts ever anyways.
I just assumed it was Cassandra Cain, and then they called her Black Bat, and I was like, oh, I guess she's Black Bat now.
Yeah,
well, she's got the same logo as Cassandra Cain.
Oh, I mean, that sort of looks like the Batgirl logo anyway, so, like...
She's got exactly the same costume as Cassandra Cain, except a different mask.
That's pretty much enough to make me not think of Cassandra Cain, where it's like, oh, I don't see what, you know... Since one of those things, like, I don't doubt that it's her, it's just more... That wasn't where my mind went right away. I didn't think it... I just thought, like many other characters, like, just some new creation that exists, because it exists. And
yes.
We have a new mystery introduced. Who is the new wingman?
Right. It's someone that has to redeem himself.
Well, that's the thing. Like,
this is an opportunity to salvage a reputation.
I took that as, well, I mean, it has a dual thing of salvaging Wingman and that person. Like, is it supposed to be a redemption for, like, since Wingman, the last time we saw that character, it was, like, in the Black Glove arc, League of Heroes thing, where he was the bad guy.
Right, but, I mean, you could interpret it that way, but you could also...
Yeah, that's how I interpreted it right away.
But yet... He says, your identity has to remain a mystery no matter what. And then the guy says, I get it, Bruce. So he's on a first-name basis with Batman. So it has to be someone... Maybe it's Hush. Maybe it's Tommy Elliot. Is that his name?
Yeah. Maybe it's Wingman.
Maybe it's actually Wingman.
Yeah. Maybe it's the Joker.
If it's Dr. Hurt, I'll be really surprised.
aside from the fact that Judd Winnick's writing a thing with the Red Hood.
Yes.
Todd, that was a thought that I had that it's like, oh, wait, probably not.
No, it could still be Jason Todd. It wouldn't matter.
Well, I mean, yeah, it could be, but I... Somehow I doubt it is, though.
I think that the fact that Judd Winnick's writing Red Hood makes no difference as to whether or not this could be Jason Todd.
I guess it comes down to the question of how screwed up is the editorial section at DC?
It's screwed up in the sense that I think Grant Morrison is allowed to do what he wants, which is great as far as I'm concerned. And everyone else has to either follow his lead or ignore it. And they may not even know what his lead is until after it comes out.
Yeah, I just assume that at least editorial has a handle on that would, you know, try to not have things happen that are completely contradictory to what's going on in Morrison stuff.
Maybe. Except when does this take place compared to the Red Hood, Batman or Robin arc? Who knows?
Yeah, but I would still assume that they'd try to not have stuff totally...
Yeah, this is pure speculation by us, and I don't know. I'm probably wrong about...
Like, I don't think it's probably Jason Todd anyways, but my assumption's probably wrong anyways, just because if they've demonstrated anything over the past few years is that they have no handle on that sort of thing at all. Marvel or DC. Like, Marvel is notorious for that sort of thing, where it's like, if Bendis feels like writing something, they just let him do it no matter... what else is going on with that character anywhere else. No matter what else he's even done with that character at some point.
Right.
I swear to God, I think they just look at his scripts and check for typos.
Or actually change the misspellings.
I'm not sure. I think they'd send it back to him and say, this word's misspelled. Do you want to correct it? And then if he says no, they go, okay, yes sir, Mr. Bendis, sir.
I doubt it.
I doubt it too, but they haven't really proven me wrong on that theory anyways.
Oh, Brian Michael Bendis. I do read most of his comics, except for his... I read everything he writes except for his Ultimate Universe stuff.
I don't read Ultimate Spider-Man. I just dropped Scarlet.
Oh, yeah. And Scarlet, which is bad.
I don't read Powers.
I read Powers.
I've that's one of those ones that I always keep me to, like, start buying and trade or whatever. And just buy other stuff, because who knows why.
I went through a phase where I read a bunch of Powers and then sold my entire Powers collection on eBay because I was so consistently repulsed. I'll use the word repulsed by how poorly he ended the arcs. I was always like, really? He didn't stick this landing? Come on! And so I was like, I'm done with this series. And then about 2 years later, I found a lot on eBay of all the Powers issues. And it was about the same price as I sold mine for, except I had 2 extra years worth of Powers in there. I was like, ah, crap, and I just bought it all back.
Hey, selling stuff and then buying it all for the same price with added stuff, that's a pretty sweet deal.
Yeah, it certainly didn't hurt me in the long run at all. I didn't read a bunch of the stuff in the middle. I read the first few arcs, and I've read all the stuff from Icon, but I didn't read the last, 20 issues of the Image run.
So I think I read the first 2 or 3 issues of when it was just most recently relaunched again.
Yeah.
Because we had the PDFs for them.
Right. Yeah, I mean, there's not much to it. And actually, Oming is actually writing a lot of it as far as plotting. And Ben is kind of, talking to Oming about the overall plot. And then Oming, just draws it. And then Bendis comes in and puts in some dialogue with Oming, adding some dialogue of his own. So it's much more of a co-creation than anything else Bendis has ever done, really.
Yeah, that would explain why I probably didn't like it as much.
Yeah, it didn't have a whole lot to it in the Icon run. There was more to it earlier. It was much more Bendis-y when it first launched.
Yeah, those Icon issues, more than anything, they felt really brief in that way that Bendis comics... They can be brief, but it didn't feel the same sort of brief.
Yeah, but, I like Oming's art enough that I don't mind buying that still.
Yeah. I kind of want to see if Marvel and DC ever do another crossover, they need Bendis and Morrison going back and forth.
That would be pretty cool. That's not going to happen.
That's not going to happen?
It would sell well, though.
It would sell huge. Even if they just did a thing where Marvel and DC made an arrangement to have Morrison write... an arc of the Avengers, well, Bendis wrote an arc of JLA, just under the agreement of, we're doing this to just do a big event where, we technically don't have to cooperate beyond letting our, exclusive writer do something for the other guys. I don't even think they'd do, something like that, which, again, it would involve no other, dealing with the companies, it's just... This writer submits scripts and talks to this editor and back and, that sort of thing. It's not really, a crossover, per se. But I don't think they'd even do that, even though that would be huge numbers for both of them. Which is weird.
Yeah, I can understand why they don't want to help each other out. But I would expect that even in this marketplace, if they did a crossover with some big talent involved, that they would sell... twice as much as the top-selling comic. I think they would sell, over 200,000, 250,000 copies of the crossover series. And I would think that would kind of sustain itself afterwards. It would create a kind of enthusiasm for both companies instead of them picking each other off. Maybe not. Maybe it wouldn't matter at all. Maybe there's only 100,000 comic book readers left.
Yeah. Although I'd screw the whole crossover thing and just go straight to the Amalgam comics again.
Yeah, so I don't think
that's... Screw the regular crossover and go to Amalgam.
I don't think that sells as well, though.
Yeah, but they were so much better.
They were better. I mean, I'm not going to say they weren't. But they were almost exclusively better because of the art. It's not like... I can't remember a single story I read from the Amalgam run. I just remember the
art.
Yeah,
but also like, remember at what time those came out. That was definitely during the time where Marvel and DC did not have the strongest writing staff.
Even so, you can only do so much in a single issue, I think.
Yeah, I think so too, but I would be curious to see what the creative teams now, which is a lot more balanced between writing and art.
Really? But don't you think the Amalgam stuff was just like a one-note joke?
I don't know. I'd have to see what they did now and if they adhered to what happened before or if they just came up with new stuff now.
I mean, what are you going to do? You're telling a Batman crossed over with Wolverine amalgamated series? Well, like how
automatically you have Dake and Wayne.
Yeah.
Well, dude. Dake and Damian both invented since then. Splice those two guys together. An oddly bald, hairy, tattooed 8-year-old.
You're the only person in the world who even thinks that's a cool idea. And you probably do legitimately think it's a cool idea.
I think that's an awesome idea, man.
That's for you. That will sell one copy.
I want to see Dakin Wayne, son of Dark Claw. Dark Claw.
Oh, man. You should write and draw that, even if you have no drawing talent whatsoever. You should write and draw that as a webcomic.
Oh, I've considered doing webcomic stuff. Not like that, but...
You should just do that. That would be great.
Yeah. The only one I ever want to do, I would never actually put my name on it because, well, I swear to God, if someone in the real world Googled me and figured out, like, it would not go over well. It's the sort of thing, like employers find out you're doing this, they will fire you kind of thing. Which was my comic strip called Baby Killers.
Yeah.
Which I still love. I love, anytime I look over those, like, 30, like, three-panel scripts I wrote in, like, a single afternoon, I just love it so much. The horrible wrongness of it.
Well, I think it's a Mark Miller idea is what it is.
To be fair, I make fun of everybody involved in the abortion debate.
Oh, man. Maybe, what's that? What's that company that does the Sarah Palin comics?
Blue Water?
Blue Water. Maybe Blue Water will publish it, because it'll sell some issues. Oh, Blue Water. 12 years from now, someone's going to write a retrospective on Blue Water. That's going to happen. Someone's going to reflect fondly on this era of cheesy pop celebrity tie-in comics.
Yeah. The thing that, and I'm saying this now, and someone else will probably hear it and do it, I kept looking when I was buying stuff from Mile High when they had their eBay store totally up and running for that Just Imagine stuff by Stan Lee and DC.
Yeah.
Thinking, how have I not seen someone do, like, a big series of posts on this stuff?
Because, for some reason, that stuff's hard to find cheap.
No, well, the thing is that Mile High had, like, I think there was 12 books. They had, like, 9 of them, and they were pretty cheap. It's just finding, like, those other 3 kind of things.
They should all be in the dollar bin, because I don't know anybody who actually bought them at cover price. But yet, because I've looked for them. I always thought, oh, one day I'll buy these in the dollar bin because I like almost all the artists involved.
Yeah, and it seems like it would just be...
And I've never been able to find them at a cheap price. I mean, you know, I've found them less than cover price, but I've never been able to find them at $1 each, which is what I'm the maximum willing to pay.
Well, I'm looking on eBay right now. Let's
see. You can get me a set for $12?
Let's see. Full runs. How much is a full run? 13 prestige books, $72 plus shipping.
Exactly.
Let's look at the graphic novels, trade paperbacks, because those could be a bit better.
Yeah, I don't know why they're so expensive.
Okay,
I literally don't know anybody who bought them.
Okay, these are not actually trade paperbacks or graphic novels, people. These are, like, where's the... Oh, you can get 2 of the 3... Oh, you can get 2 of the 3 trades... For $13.50 each plus shipping. They have 2 and 3. And then there's 1 copy of 1 that would probably be a bit better for you because it doesn't have Canadian shipping specified. But it's like $24. Yeah, that's... See, that's, again, what I was talking about earlier. It's like, these are hard to find, and people are charging a lot. Who's paying these prices for these comic books that were not good? It seems weird.
Yeah, I want to go to a convention where they have all of them bundled and shrink-wrapped into a big brick and pay $10 for it.
I've never actually looked at my comic book shop. I should. There's a couple things I was going to actually look for this week in the back issue bins, but then Michelle drove me because she was home. So I didn't really want to stick around and look around too much since she was there. Because I don't want to make her stand there and wait around while I look for stuff.
Yeah, because then you can't look. You can't really look.
You can't really look. Well, if only just because it's rude to spend a lot of time when someone's just doing you a favor by driving you there to pick up your stuff.
Right.
And
Who drew Just Imagine Stanley's The Flash? Because that one, someone has it on eBay or on Amazon for 69.
Kevin McGuire.
69 cents for that one.
Really?
Amazon used. Like new, Amazon, 69 cents.
Kevin McGuire did that one, according to eBay here.
Well, I have to pay for shipping, so I'm not going to. But yes, all right. Any other comics you want to talk about? Or you want to go to the lightning round?
Let's look through. Do you have anything really to say about Punisher Max?
It's good. I like it.
I do too.
That's it. That would also be in my top 10 of the year so far. Punisher Max would be in there. iZombie would be in there because of that one issue. I think Detective Comics would be in there.
Detective Comics, I'm not sure. That's a comp.
I love that comic.
I don't love it. I've liked a couple of the issues a lot. But
I like the last two a ton.
Yeah, I wasn't as impressed with the most recent issue as you were, but we established that when we talked about it.
I actually liked the last two issues more than this Batman Incorporated issue. I like this Batman Incorporated issue just fine, but I really like the Detective.
To think of what would be my top 10 of the year so far.
What else has come out this year? Anything good?
Deadpool Max would probably be in
there. Oh, Deadpool Max would be in my top 5, definitely.
Punisher Max would.
I'm thinking of other independent stuff. I guess Mr. Wonderful would be in my top 10, because I really like that.
Haven't read that one yet.
I also got the... what's it called? That this is a dumb conversation, because I can't remember what it's called or who it's by. Something. Some book. The Ben Catchor book. I bought that. I haven't read it yet.
I'm not sure if I'd put Butcher Baker in my top 10 yet.
The Cardboard Valise, that's the one, the Ben Catcher book. I haven't read it. Butcher Baker, man. It might, you know what, it probably cracks my top 10. I like it.
It probably would, if only from the fact if I listed out everything that I've read so far in the year, it would make it by, like, default kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
Like, Scalped. I've liked it.
Scalped is always in my top 10.
Yeah, Scalped automatically in there.
I think Secret Warriors would be in my top 10.
Yeah, that would be. Thunder Agents would probably make it.
Nope, I like Thunder Agents, but I don't think it's...
I think it'd be like a 9 or 10 book. Like, I think it'd be near the bottom. The Boys would probably still be in there just because...
I don't know if there's anything outside of Marvel and DC that I would really... I have liked a couple of the Hellboy one-shots that came out this year. There's that Kevin Nolan issue and the Richard Corbin issue. Those guys are
I didn't get the Kevin Nolan one. I totally forgot to pick up the one that came out this week.
Oh, you should get the Kevin Nolan one because that's a great-looking comic.
I don't remember if I even saw it or not. It was one of those ones that I might have had in my mind. If I see it, I'll look through it and
you'll fall in love. Daredevil Reborn, not in my top 10.
I'm trying to think of... No, not enough of... The second arc of The Avengers wasn't really good enough to make top 10.
No, I like the art. That's about it.
Yeah.
I don't even remember what else came out so far. Comics. Oh, I like Bakuman a lot. That'd be my one token manga entry, but I do like Bakuman.
Another thing, like Weapons of the Meta Baron. I'm not saying it'd make my top 10 because it probably wouldn't.
Yeah.
under the standards that I usually set of new, like if it's into my top 10, it's not like a reprint or anything like that. But that's new for North America. Should that count as a release for 2011 under the standards that I usually put for my top 10?
I wouldn't count it personally.
Yeah, I wasn't thinking either, but it's hard to tell, it's hard to judge with stuff that came out. If this is its first chance to be read in this language, though.
Yeah.
Like, and by the same token, like, if I was going to do my top books of 2011 that came out this year, which I would never do because I don't think I read enough new stuff, like, odds are when Haruki Murakami's new novel comes out in October, it would make the list, even though it came out in 2008, really.
Fair enough.
Like, how
I think
that
that's true. Well, I mean, with Bakuman, obviously there's a delay in the translation release over here, but that's it's something that's recent, of recent vintage.
So. Yeah, Weapons of the Metabaron's pretty recent.
I don't even know. I thought Travis Charest drew that like 6 years ago or something.
No, he started it and did all that stuff a while ago, but it doesn't mean that it wasn't released somewhat recently. I'm just looking because they have the French. Oh, it doesn't. Yeah, okay, Wikipedia, thanks for not actually giving the year for that one book. Yeah, every other Metabarons book they list has a year for when it came out. Not Weapons of the Metabarons. Jackasses.
And people who are listening to this in May, I think there's still time, Jason Latour's first series as a writer is coming out this summer. And it's got really sweet artwork. And it's called Loose Ends by 12 Gauge Comics. 12 Gauge Comics puts out some good comics, and I never read any of their comics. Hmm. Have you seen any 12 Gauge comics ever? Have you ever seen them on the stands?
I don't think so. At least not to the point where I noticed them.
So here's some of the creators who put out comics from 12 Gauge. You get, what was it? This is not a convenient list. So, Jason Pearson?
Crap.
He's good. Obviously, Jason Latour, we already said that.
Crap.
I don't know what this one is. I'm trying to find examples of things that would be somewhat impressive, and I can't find any. Tony Shastin, I don't even know who that is, but I'm not that interested in what he does. Whoever he is. Paul Jenkins, creator of the Century. What else comes out? Tom Mandrake? Like, I've never actually seen these comics on the stands, but there's some significant creators on them. Brian Stelfreeze. It's good stuff, man. Cody Chamberlain, David Tishman. I mean, these are people who do things that people read, but yet I've never seen any of these comics on any comic book shop stand ever.
Yeah, looking through it a little bit, I'm not seeing anything that I've really seen.
Rebecca Isaacs. I mean, you know, these are good people.
So. Yeah, we should probably move on to something that's not...
Yeah, I'm just listening. You can interrupt and like start moving the podcast forward while I just name names.
Just name names.
I'm just naming names, but yes. Loose Ends by Jason Latour. I guarantee it's good, because everything Jason Latour does is good. I guarantee it.
Everything?
Everything he's done so far.
Everything?
Yes.
Every single thing.
Well, his Vertigo crime book was printed terribly, but it looks good. The printing looks like crap, but I can't blame him for that.
I'm actually amused that me just repeating that eventually made you go like, well, there's this one thing.
It does work. It's an effective technique.
Well, I was expecting you to keep stonewalling me until finally I just gave up.
No.
But you caved.
After three tries, that's all it took.
Wow. See, you're a quitter. Oh.
Yeah, let's.
If we actually did this radio style, by this point I would have queued up that episode of The Simpsons where Bart becomes a menu delivery boy for a Thai restaurant or whatever.
Yeah.
And when he quits, the guy starts going, "Quitter boy, quitter boy." And every time I felt like making fun of you, I just hit a button to queue up that sound effect.
Right, that's why I hate radio, because of that.
Yeah. But I just did it there, so, I mean, like, later I could just take that little chunk that I just said and splice it in at various points that are appropriate.
You should do that. You should. Why don't you just... Okay, why don't you just continue the podcast with just splice together audio from my previous appearances and then all your hilarious audio gags that you put in between.
Whoa.
Holy cow. Hey, if you want to buy Travis Charest Space Girl Volume 1, it's going to run you $169 on Amazon.
Wow, because, no.
If you want to buy Wildcats X-Men The Golden Age Number 1, $198 on Amazon. Not
really?
Kidding.
Who would ever buy that?
I have that comic.
Although, I will say, I am tempted by that, it doesn't come out according to Amazon.ca until September, but definitive irredeemable.
Yeah, me too. What do you think about what's his name leaving the art? Peter Krause leaving the artwork? So it's going to be Eduardo Barreto and Diego Barreto.
I don't like that Peter Krause is leaving, because, as I said in my review of issue 25, although the Diego, or is it Eduardo or Diego? It's Diego doing the art right now, right?
Diego's the fill-in artist for Irredeemable.
Well, he's not really the fill-in, he's more like the co-artist.
He rotates with Peter Krause.
No, they don't even rotate, they just share the issue.
Well, they were rotating. Or they were taking turns.
For a while, no.
Diego Barreto drew a bunch of full issues.
Yeah, he did for a little bit, and then once Peter Krause came back, they've just shared issues.
Fine, I agree with you.
Well, I mean, it was like Peter Krause would draw whatever's happening with Plutonian, and
right.
Barreto would draw everything else.
Yeah, they were doing the parallel plots.
I think both of those guys are so good at drawing like that, I hate to say it, like generic superhero style. Like, I hate to put it that way because it puts down the art when I don't mean it to, really, but they're so good at drawing books like that it looks like the sort of superhero art you'd find in, like, your random Marvel or DC comic.
Yes.
That, and Peter Krause especially has gotten to a very good polished version of that, that it works so well with what Wade is doing on the writing. Because it allows Wade to be even more subversive because he has an artist who's drawing it like it's a regular superhero comic.
See, I agree with that, except I think Peter Krause is more subtle, and I think it's more emotionally effective, and I think Diego Barreto, as clean as he is as a stylist, doesn't get to those layers that Peter Krause does. Peter Krause can pull off character stuff that Diego Barreto can't. Eduardo Barreto can't either. Eduardo Barreto's problem is that his characters are too stiff. I think he's a good artist, and especially when he's drawing more noir or western-y stuff, I think I like his style quite a bit. But traditionally on superheroes, he's been a little stiff, and I think Diego also has that. His characters don't resonate with me the way Peter Krause's do, even though on a quick flip, if you flip into the comic, it looks like Peter Krause is drawing in what you would call a generic style. I agree. I think it ends up being far more effective when you see it page after page, though.
No, I agree. That's why I didn't want it to be entirely putting him down, because I think he does something really effective with what Wade wants. So I'm sad to see him go.
Yeah.
But I think the book will still be in good enough hands.
I think so, too. I think it's time for the final lightning round ever, because we should probably wrap this up.
Okay. And this is where I'll insert the second music cue.
Lightning round! Is that the music cue?
No, it's, I don't know where I'm inserting it. I guess I inserted it just somewhere right there.
like. Right behind the boom! I feel so good right here. Yeah.
And that was. And it's. You're gonna like almost laugh when you hear the title of the song, but it's Lover Call by Danko Jones.
Lover Call.
Trust me, the way that song begins is very good, energetic, jumping into something kind of music.
All right, lighting round. What do we have? What do we have for us?
I'm lighting up. Let's start off with Sean Witzke, because I like him best.
Hello, Sean, you're the best.
Right, top five artists all time without thinking. Go.
You want me to go first?
Go.
Do you want me to rank them in order?
Top five. Quit trying to stall so you can think.
Top five artists of all time. Jack Kirby, Mobius, Frank Whiteley, J.H. Williams, and Howard Chaykin.
Okay, I'll go Kirby, Ditko. Damn it, now I'm starting to think. Miller. Dylan.
Wow, Steve Dylan cracks the top five.
Yeah, I'll admit I was partly...
No, just next. What's next? What's next? I was counting to go.
Yeah, I guess we're not going to discuss that one at all.
No, that's four. Awesome. You need one more.
No, I said Phillips at the end.
Oh, Phillips?
Yeah, yeah. You were like, jumping on Dylan.
Phillips, I can see. I'm surprised Dylan makes top five. Anyway, yeah, moving on. Next one.
Ryan Lee asks, what do you think has potential to stick around after Flashpoint?
Not Thomas Wayne as Batman.
Not Cyborg as a character that matters, no matter how hard Jeff
Jones tries. Snap! Take that, Marvel.
I'm sorry, that's what he's trying to do here, and it's like, dude, no, that's a C-list character.
I radically disagree because Cyborg was part of the Super Friends when I was growing up and part of the Teen Titans when I was growing up. So Cyborg matters to me every day. No, I'm joking, but I think Cyborg is... He's not an A-list character, but I think he's never going away.
Think he's going away. I think he's just... I'm sorry, Geoff Johns, you're not doing for him what Bendis did for Luke Cage.
Okay, so to actually think this through... Flashpoint issue 5 is going to change the DC universe so severely that they're going to only spotlight this one issue. Something is going to stick around. My guess is it's the Wonder Woman Aquaman. Something to do with that. Because those characters suck. So they need to do something with them.
Yeah, I'd say the Aquaman thing, if only from the fact that there's an Aquaman series coming at some point.
Although Geoff Johns just queued up Aquaman in Brightest Day, so is he really going to queue up Aquaman in Brightest Day and then just do an alternate reality version of him? I don't know. But I would say Aquaman and Wonder Woman seems like it would be the type of thing that could stick around and actually be better. Oh, I think the Shazam stuff might stick around.
What is so, the Shazam stuff?
In Flashpoint number one, Captain Marvel is actually... What is he? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. Is that right? Yeah. He's six different children. Six different young people who, when they say the magic word, Captain Marvel appears. So each of his attributes, each of his letters, a kid has. So there's like a kid who's got the wisdom of Solomon, and there's the kid who's got like the speed of Mercury. And then these kids all say the magic word. I think that can stick around because that's a high concept revamp of the Shazam idea.
That sounds bad.
It's not bad. It could work.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not saying it can't work. I'm just saying that conceptually that just sounds dumb.
Nope, it's fine.
No, that sounds overly complicated and kind of stupid.
Nope, it's fine.
I love you not like... You just... No, it's fine.
It's fine. I'm not going to change my mind on this. It's fine.
Not even an attempt to really defend it. Just, it's fine.
Well, because Captain Marvel doesn't make sense anyway. How can Billy Batson turn into Captain Marvel and have the wisdom of Solomon and be anything other than a bland character? So, this Captain Marvel... Well, what also makes him different is he's pissed off. So, this Captain Marvel's pissed off. But then he also, he can turn into, like, six precocious kids. That's something. I know you hate children, Chad. We've already established this.
I love kids, man. Not in that bad way.
I don't know if you do. All you want to do is swear around them, let's be honest.
No, there's this little kid who got on the bus today when I was taking the bus home from work. And this kid was so excited, like stand up on the seat by, the open window and watch, the bus go down the street that way. That it was like, the kid was so excited to just stick his head right at the open window. It was great.
Chad, that's how I feel every day of my life.
Cool.
What's next?
2D's The Last Tim, can you give us your thoughts on Morrison's Here Comes Tomorrow?
Well, I wrote about it in my column about Grant Morrison's new X-Men. I am not a fan of Here Comes Tomorrow. That's the final arc. Am I right in that?
Yeah.
That's the Mark Silvestri.
That's one of those things that sounded familiar to me, so I just Googled it myself right now just to make sure I had it right.
That's the Mark Silvestri-drawn final arc of Morrison's X-Men. I think thematically, I understand what he's doing. I think I even get why Mark Silvestri would be an interesting choice to draw it. I think it doesn't work. I just think it doesn't work. I mean, I like it in concept, I don't like it in execution. It's fine. I don't dislike it, but it's not as successful as almost everything else Morrison did on X-Men.
Yeah, it's like you say, in theory and conceptually it works when you stop and think about it. But as a place to end that run, it's not the best way to do it. If only from the fact that they got Silvestri and 20,000 assistants to do the art.
Yes. I do not love the art.
And if only because the existence of that arc kind of ruins the ending of the previous arc, where you have, those 2 to 4 pages of, oh, now here's the future, and people on the moon finding the Phoenix Egg, and it's kind of like, I would have almost preferred his arc just ends with Jean dead, Cyclops yelling for Zorn, and not realizing, oh wait, Wolverine just chopped his head off.
Mm.
That seemed almost like the way, if you're going to leave, I would have almost preferred he left then. That would have been kind of like a cool way to just walk away.
I do not disagree with that statement.
But no, if I look at it from purely writing standpoint, Here Comes Tomorrow is interesting. Oddly, it feels almost like, even though it happens at the end of the arc, it feels like one of those stories you'd see a writer do where they had a run, then five or ten years later they come back and they do an out-of-continuity miniseries. And it felt kind of like that for some reason.
But it was also one of those things, just, it's not exactly the same. In a similar vein as what Morrison did on The Invisibles, where he ends the run with a coda that takes place in the future. That's an epilogue, but it ties everything up thematically.
Yeah, except that worked a lot better on The Invisibles.
It did, but did it work a lot better because Frank Quitely drew it? Yes, it did. Had Frank Quitely drawn Here Comes Tomorrow, it would have worked a whole lot better. So I don't know how much Mark Silvestri sabotaged the interest I have in it, but it's possible he sabotaged all of it.
Probably. Okay, Brian Wagner asks, for some reason, just at you.
Ha, Tim, you can answer too.
Tim, if you've read them, how are Marijuana Man and the Simonson Thor Omnibus?
Oh, this is really easy to answer. I have not read either.
Me neither.
I own Marijuana Man. Do you own it?
No, my shop wasn't getting any copies, so I didn't bother to,
Yeah, I got it at Amazon at 40% off. That's the only reason I bought it. I wasn't going to pay the full price for that.
I'll wait and see. I figure I'll be able to get it cheap still in the future at some point, or they'll release a paperback edition or something.
Yeah, I really am not interested in its message about drugs at all.
Yeah.
But it does look damn good. And I'm sure Joe Casey threw some stuff in there that's interesting in its own way, but I bought it and I haven't felt compelled to read it. Simonson Thor Omnibus I probably will not buy, although my shop had a 40% off all of its Marvel hardcover sale, so I did buy a couple omnibus editions this week, but they didn't, he didn't have the Thor omnibus, so I didn't buy it.
Yeah, I don't plan to get... Well, I plan to get Marijuana Man at some point, if only from the weird obsessive Joe Casey.
Joe Casey, gotta catch them all.
Gotta catch them all, but there's plenty of other stuff. Like, I've yet to get into his Kiss or G.I. Joe stuff, so...
Yeah, but Joe Casey did say to us, Marijuana Man is his most Kafka-esque work recently.
Yeah, except every review I've read of it suggests... No, it's not.
It's not, really. I would say... Butcher Baker is more of that.
Yeah. Okay, Sam Mildner asks, do you listen to podcasts? Why? Which ones? Do they change your comic habits?
You can go first on this.
We've covered podcasts before, haven't we?
I don't know. We might as well talk about it in our
Right now, I listen to the odd episode of Wait What? And usually now I don't even like download it. I just stream it on their site if I'm like in the mood to just stick it on. Because that way, if I feel like stopping, it doesn't... Like, I don't have to, like, download and then delete a file. It's just... I play it until I've decided, okay, I don't want to listen anymore.
And correct me if I'm wrong, but you do not even own an MP3 player.
I don't own an MP3 player.
Right. No. You're that guy.
I listen to the odd bits and pieces of that Iceberg and Firestorm podcast, the TV critics.
Yeah, I don't like that.
That's more if I look at... Because they're pretty good at giving you a list of what they talk about and... even what times during the podcast stuff pops up and for how long. So it's very easy that if there's something you want to like see what they have to say about it, you can just go to that point in the episode. So I'll do that. On 401 Mania, the wrestling site I contribute to, they recently, like a week and a half ago, recently started doing a live podcast thing that's more like a radio show on Blog Talk Radio. So if anybody even goes there and downloads the episode they did last night for post-TNA Impact, I pop up on that because I called in on Skype.
Nice.
So I listen to that, if only because, you know, it's people that I don't know, but people whose stuff I read, some, you know, talk about wrestling stuff that I like. I can call in now, participate if I want a little bit. Other than that, I can't really think of... not really a podcast per se, but I watch the streaming stuff of the guys who do Drunk Jays fans. It's a Blue Jays blog that are smart guys, Dustin Parks and Andrew Stoughton. They do a streaming thing for the website of a sports cable channel here in Canada, so I watch their stuff. It's only like half an hour talking about the Blue Jays. Other than that, nothing really... I keep... Maybe now I'll track down that when you talked about Joey Ausilio and Alec Berg, their podcast, see what they're like.
Alec Berry, yeah. The Berry, the Chemical Box.
Alec
They've
Berg.
Only done six episodes,
Alec
but it's
Berg.
Good.
Alec Berg was an executive producer and a character on Seinfeld.
So
that's where I got that name.
I listen to podcasts exclusively on my commute, so that's... 35 minutes each way. So I listen to over an hour of podcasts every day. So I listen to every episode of WTF with Mark Maron. I listen to The Nerdist every once in a while, depending on who the guest is. For comics podcasts, I listen to Word Balloon only when it's someone who I really want to hear talk, because I, as I've said before, can only take so much John Suntress. I listen to every episode of Wait What. I listen to The Chemical Box. I listen to a couple gaming podcasts. I listen to Fear the Boot, which I was once supposed to be a guest on, but we had technical difficulties and that didn't work, and we haven't rescheduled since. And I really like The Podcast, which is a good gaming podcast, even though they rarely talk about games. What else do I listen to? That's pretty much it. I listen to those episodes. A lot of those shows come out pretty regularly, so I listen to basically a new one of those every day, and that keeps me occupied for the week. And if there are other podcasts that pop up, I just listen to them occasionally. Ink Studs, for example. So Ink Studs has got a pretty extensive back catalog. But have you ever listened to Ink Studs at all?
Don't even know what it is. Well, I mean, beyond it being a podcast, apparently.
Well, it's also a book of... He's put it... Crap, what's the guy's name? Robin, whatever. He has a book of his interviews, and the book is pretty impressive by itself. But he's got all these interviews with great comic book creators, and a lot of alternative independent comic book creators. He's the guy who did the Al Columbia interview, which is one of my favorite all-time interviews.
Yeah, I've heard you talk about that one, yeah.
Yeah, that's a really strong interview. But, like John Suntris, except John Suntris interjects more annoying things every once in a while. And I'm not talking about, if you're listening to Word Balloon, I'm not talking about the stuff where John Suntris references like 1950s pop culture. I like that stuff. I just get annoyed when John
kisses ass,
just goes out of his way not to criticize, or he only has like a vague idea of something that's going on, and so he doesn't dig deeper with a follow-up question that would make sense, and so it becomes too fluffy most of the time. But anyway, on Inkstuds, it's so dependent on the quality of the speaker, and a lot of these independent comics guys or alternative comics guys are weirdly inarticulate. For example, James Stokoe. Orkstein's pretty great. The James Stokoe interview is one of the most painful interviews to listen to because there's no substance to it. I'm sure James Stokoe could talk about his craft and his interest in comics at length, but he doesn't on that podcast. He talks at length, but it's about nothing. It's almost as if he's distracted by the very idea of delving deeply into any thoughts about comics, but yet they keep talking for a long time. It's not even that long of an episode, but it feels like a long time. So, yeah, some of the episodes are really weak in that series, but some are good. So, yeah, I listen to a ton of podcasts, and I really appreciate a good podcast.
I find it interesting that you have, like, the odd podcast that's not comics, but it seems very comic-centric, whereas I've picked, like, the one comics podcast I like, and that's the only one I ever listen to.
Yeah. Well, I think Wait What is the best. I think that's the best comics podcast.
Well, I mean, now that we're done, it is.
Yeah, even when we're going, it still is.
Oh, no.
Jeff and Graham are just good at talking about stuff.
They're good. They're not better than us, though.
Okay, that's fair.
Okay, they probably are.
They're just better.
I'll finally admit, I think they're better. But then again, like as we've established when we've talked privately, we both secretly seem to like hate our podcast.
No, I don't hate it. I think it actually is pretty good.
I secretly kind of great. Hate. I kind of hate everything I have to say ever when I think about what I said on the podcast.
I don't have that problem. Oh, I also listen to War Rocket Ajax because I like Chris Sims a lot. So there's that.
Okay, Ryan Lindsay asks, if you could have any guest on the podcast, who would it be and what three questions would you ask them?
I don't really care.
You know, like...
If we could, I think, honestly, I think we could, and I'm not just saying that to, like, show how cool we could be, but I think if we really wanted to, we could probably get almost anyone on the podcast.
I
wouldn't mind talking to President Obama about his comic book reading from his childhood. Like, that's literally, that's a guy I know I couldn't get on a podcast. But any comics creator, I think, okay, maybe a Frank Miller or Bill Sienkiewicz, one of those two guys would be good. But everybody else, I think we could figure out a way to get to some degree. I mean, I could get Grant Morrison on a podcast. I could get certainly Jason Aaron.
Well, that's a bold statement. Well, not a bold statement, like... There's certain people I don't think we could get. If only because I don't think they'd feel like doing it.
Who don't you think we could get?
I'm not sure we could get Warren Ellis. I don't know if he'd actually want to do it.
I think we could get Warren Ellis. Warren Ellis is the subject of a documentary.
I think that's almost the reason why we wouldn't be able to get him. You'd be like, I just talked about that at great length. I don't feel like talking to people anymore.
Yeah, I think... I don't know that we would bother... There'd probably be some hoops we have to jump through, and we have to be patient and try several times. But anyway, yeah, so President Obama talking about reading comics when he was a kid, that would be the only thing interesting to me. How about you? Who would you want to have, and what would you ask them?
Oh, God, I don't want anybody. I didn't even want Joe Casey, technically.
No, you didn't. That is a fact. You were like, yeah, really? This isn't going to be a good idea. It's like, oh, it'll be fine. And, of course, it was fine.
It worked out okay, but, yeah, I was...
It worked out well. It was the best comic book interview anybody's ever heard.
Okay, I don't know about that. But
that's what people are saying.
Yeah, people say stuff, though. I don't believe them.
It was a good interview. It was an actual conversation with the man.
Yeah,
we were talking.
That worked out well, but yeah, I'm not... I don't know. I don't really... We've established I don't care about that sort of thing, necessarily. I think anybody who seemed kind of smart, it would be interesting to have them on, and not in that let's ask them questions interview kind of way. I think it would be interesting possibly to just have them on for a conversation.
Well, here's the thing, too. Other than Joe Casey, almost nobody in the industry is willing to be honest about what really went on with any given project. That's just a fact. I mean, I think maybe Frank Miller would be, which is why he'd be interesting to have on. But so even if you had someone on who you really liked and you wanted to ask them, hey, what really went on with this, they're not going to say.
Well, that's the okay, for that reason alone, I want Fraction on, and we will fucking press that guy.
Yeah, but right, he's not going to say because he's...
Well, that's the thing.
He does his job and he gets things done. I'm not going to throw his colleagues into the bus.
I know, and I'd feel bad if it actually, like, we pressed him and eventually he was just worn down enough that he let stuff slip, and then it actually had repercussions that affected his life.
Yeah.
Like, come on, we'd feel bad about that.
Which is why nobody would do that. He wouldn't participate in such a thing, of course. He's a professional.
Yeah, that's the kind of thing, like, I think it would be... If you got the right person, you could have interesting conversations. Like, even with those people that aren't going to say certain things, you could still have some interesting conversation with them. But with people who aren't willing to be completely honest about any of their profession, like, all of their professional life, there's just limitations that would eventually piss us off.
Right.
Like, people don't have to be honest about their personal life. I don't really care about their personal life, but... Like, what's the fun of having a guy like Matt Fraction on if you can't say, okay, were you pissed off about the really crappy art on your comics? Like, you said it's Joe Casey, you don't even, like, you. I'm talking about, like, not even, like, saying specifically. Like, you can just ask, like, are you pissed off at the crappy art on comics that you write? Joe Casey would say, hell yes.
Right.
He'll have no qualms saying that he's dealt with some very bad artists, and then he'll turn around and talk up the really good artists. Other guys won't say that because they're afraid. Like, it's not hard to figure out who we're talking about.
Yeah, well, I wouldn't. If I worked for Marvel, I wouldn't say that either, because you're working with these people. They are your colleagues. You do not criticize them in public. That's not what you do.
Someday they will. Someday.
I hope you're right, because that does make for interesting reading or viewing. But it doesn't really matter to me, so I'm not going to bother asking them those questions. Anyway, what's next? You're jumping around. I don't even know what we're looking at here.
Yeah, because I've used up all the recent stuff. I'm looking at stuff from old ones. Here is one from Troy Wilson that we can probably say and then get rid of. Best and or favorite book/books put out by Drawn and Quarterly.
Oh, Jesus, I don't even know.
I don't know, something by Chester Brown. I Never Liked You by Chester Brown. I really like that book.
I'm looking up Drawn and Quarterly to see. I mean, I own a bunch of Drawn and Quarterly books, but which one is my favorite?
Yeah, I'll say I Never Liked You by Chester Brown. That was a book that... It was the first Chester Brown book I bought. I bought it at the University of Western Ontario bookstore, just sort of on a whim. Like, I'm like, this looks kind of interesting, and it's just very loose, very meandering, and... Not a long read at all. Like, a lot of pages just have one or two panels. But it's good. As far as autobiographical stuff goes, I think because he uses such short little quote-unquote meaningless vignettes that it doesn't really come across in that lame way that a lot of autobiographical comics do.
Yeah.
It doesn't seem like he's trying to give you, like, a... There's meaning to be had, but it's through the accumulation of these things, and he never really tries to tell you what the meaning is.
That's the kind of stuff I like, too.
Yeah, so I really... That was enough to make it so I'll check out anything he does.
So, I'm just double-checking here. Drawn and Quarterly. They put out the Acme Novelty Date Book. So anything by Chris Ware tends to win. What do they put out by Dan Klaus?
I don't know
either. I can't find it.
Let me see, I'm on their website.
Did they put out Wilson? Did Drawing
Daniel
Quarterly
Klaus
release Wilson?
Go. Wilson, yeah.
Huh. So maybe Wilson. Wilson might be my favorite drawing quarterback. Or else, what's that big, crap, what's this? I don't even remember what I'm talking about anymore. Yeah, I'll go with Wilson, and we'll move on with our lives.
Cool, works.
I don't read a lot of Jordan Quarterly, I'll be honest. And not because I don't... Well, you know what? I don't like realism. So... a lot of the Jordan Quarterly stuff is art comics in the realism genre. And I am not an enormous fan of that. So it's not necessarily for me. I prefer Picture Box. I prefer most Fantagraphics stuff to Drawn and Quarterly. So there you have it.
Okay. There's another recent one that we had, but I'll save it for the end. We're going to go through all of the whatever's in this file.
Oh, the leftovers.
Every single one, even if we just do them quick at some point.
So, okay, the recent Patrick, one, oh, you're, the, is that from
I'm saving that one for the end.
Jim, is that the one you're saving?
Yeah, because I just saw it, because I did a search on your name. Okay, Patrick Watson asked, did either of you read Love and Rockets number 3 from this past summer? He has more, but did either of us read that?
I read it. It was the top 10 comics of the year.
Oh, was it?
It was my top 5. It's great.
Then he sort of goes on.
You can, have you read any Love and Rockets?
No, I have one of them that a professor gave me because some student gave it to him, and he's like, you like comics, I don't really want this, do you want it?
Read Love and Rockets New Stories number 3. You don't need to even have any prior knowledge to read that. It's not that it's standalone, but it's enough of its own story, or it's enough of an anthology of stories that stand by themselves that you can read it and appreciate how good it is.
Yeah, I've never gotten into that, I think, just because it's such a big, expansive thing that it's...
Right.
It's intimidating. It's the same way, like, I've yet to just
dive
in... So is
Thor.
Same way I've yet to dive into, like, Cerebus. Because once you do, it's like you're in it for a big chunk of things.
You don't have to think of Love and Rockets that way.
Okay,
you,
I know.
You can think
of
Love and Rockets as Thor, as just a giant universe in which stories are told, and you will read some of them, but you will never read all of them.
Okay, that works for me.
Cerebus is different. You have to kind of read it all, or at least read the first 150 issues.
And then he goes on to say, Jamie's Love Bungler / Brown Town got a lot of love from reviewers and still didn't get a single Eisner nod. Chris Ware only got recognized for lettering, I believe. Did he get coloring, too?
I don't know, but the Eisners are meaningless, except when we...
But, yeah, then he asks, should the Eisners expand the jury panel and start adding 3-year terms to add some depth and consistency to the voting?
No, I don't care. Doesn't matter. It's just an award. Doesn't mean anything.
Yeah.
It's made up. It's made up like all awards.
Yeah, I mean, like, if you look at, like, the Academy Awards, do they have consistency by having, like, roughly the same giant panel of people voting every single year?
Yeah, they do have consistency.
But it's not a good consistency. It's
a bland consistency.
Yeah, so their awards, they're meaningless in the same sense, like, how is the Eisners any better than, like, my top 10 list, technically? In the sense that they get sent a lot more stuff, so they should actually be nominating better things because they've read everything, you would assume. Whereas I'm judging just by the limited stuff that I've been able to buy and read in the year.
Yeah.
But, I mean, what's the big difference really beyond that? Other than this has some name attached to it.
I'd be shocked if the Eisner's judges read more than I do. Because they don't read all the superhero comics.
No.
So, a Douglas Wolk... Somebody like that, he's read everything. Trust his opinion more than the Eisners.
Yeah. And I'll say this as a guy who was recently just a judge for Comic Awards. You know, they're nice and all, but, I mean, like, even for the Glyph Awards, I mainly went with what I was sent, and that probably covered... I don't know what percentage you'd say it covered of, like... quote-unquote black comics from the previous year, but it didn't cover all of them.
Mm-mm.
So, ultimately, it was a limited view. And, you know, you try to... I think the Eisners are effective sometimes at pointing out the odd thing, but even as Tim and I have said, like, most of the stuff they nominate, you've heard of before. Or it's one of those puzzling nominations that you haven't heard of it, then you go and look at it, and you're kind of like, how did this get nominated? So.
Hey, I have a question before we move on to, how many other inventory questions do we have?
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7.
Holy smokes. Well, let's do them quickly, but here's my quick question before that. Did you end up picking up any of the free Comic Book Day offerings when you went to your store this week?
All they had were, they had 4 of them, and they were all, like, the very kid-centric ones.
The Captain America Thor you have to get because it's the end of the Roger Langridge, Phil Somni Thor run.
Yeah, I'd like to get that.
But that was hard to find. I actually went to 3 stores that day. I brought my son with me. We went on a comic book jaunt, and he loves the Bongo comics. He loves the whatever Bongo comics has for their free comic book day. That's always his favorite comic of the year. Mm-hmm. So he just pretty much got that. And then I only one store had the Captain America Thor. Everybody else was gone. So that was the popular one. I haven't read it yet. I assume it's good because it looks good. But anyway,
I'm trying to see if it showed up on eBay and what price it was at. Not seeing it so far, but I only searched Thor the Mighty Avenger because I'm not sure what its official title was.
Yeah, it was Captain America and Thor.
Was it Captain America and Thor?
Yeah.
Let me just try Thor FCBD. See if that turns up anything. That has last year's and the Avengers one, and I can get it with just under 6 days left for just $2, I think, because with the exchange rate, my prices show up in Canadian just a little bit under the U.S. one, plus $6 shipping.
You could have just gone to a store on Saturday.
Ooh, I could buy it for, again, not a bad price, like $1.25, I want to say. I'd buy it now, but then the shipping is like $7-something. So what kills, it's not that expensive on eBay, but what would kill it for me would be shipping costs.
Shipping would kill it, yeah. Anyway, all right, that was my only question. What's
okay,
next?
Let's go through Wilson, Robert Wilson IV, who are your favorite comic artists from a storytelling perspective, aesthetics aside? Steve Dillon.
Storytelling. I will go with Frank Quitely on storytelling.
Okay. I was a lion asked a few weeks ago, well, more than a few weeks ago now, but you complained that Secret Warriors lacked a larger theme. Do you find that kind of theme present in Bendis' Avengers or John's Green Lantern? If not, in what current series do you find that?
It is present in a sense that even though Bendis is more character-centric and John's is more plot-centric, both those guys are writing traditional superhero comics in which the characters themselves are thematically bound. They're metaphorical characters who represent a certain approach to life. And Secret Warriors doesn't do that to the same extent. Secret Warriors has a bunch of characters, but they're not as clearly symbolizing things as either the Avengers or the Green Lantern characters. So that's the big difference. And there are some things that Jeff Johns and Bendis keep returning to thematically. So yeah, I think both of those series have much stronger themes. Whether or not they resonate might be a different story, but they're clearly part of the text, unlike Secret Warriors.
Good answer. That was mostly for you, and I got nothing to add, honestly.
But once again, I would just like to clarify, I really like Secret Warriors, but I do think that's a weird aspect to it that I'm trying to reconcile how I feel about the fact that it doesn't seem to have any. It is ultimately a hollow exercise, but I'm okay with that.
I'm not sure what to make of this one. This is one from Sean Witzke that I just kept passing over since like the first time we asked for questions.
Oh, Sean Witzke.
A personal favorite genre, League of Extraordinary Gentlemen / World Newton idea from both of you? Then in brackets, he says, that'll fill up some time.
I would... Well, you know, before Kill Shakespeare came out, I would have liked to see all the Shakespeare characters interact. I think Kill Shakespeare did it very poorly and kind of destroyed my interest in that idea. I really like... Trying to think of stuff that I like. Hey, I don't know. Do you know?
I don't know.
I don't friggin' know. I do like when sort of historical characters and fictional characters interact in stories in some ways. So something like The Unwritten, for example, hits a lot of my buttons. I just think that it's poorly told or told in a way that I can't connect to, because, I mean, I do understand that there's something going on there that I'm not feeling it. So Unwritten is a lot of the things I like about comics, or I like about these literary worlds crossing over with each other. But even something like, have you read any of the Jasper Ford novels? Tuesday,
no.
Next, or whatever? I can't read them. They're terrible. But it collides all these fictional realities into one. I don't know. I used to write that kind of stuff when I was a kid, but it doesn't really interest me anymore. Maybe it does, but I'm just bored with it.
Yeah, I can't think of anything that I'd actually like to see mashed up in any way like that.
I'd really like to see I'd like to see a good version of the King Arthur characters mashed up with something else. I guess fertile ground.
In some ways, the novel I wrote for my graduate degree, it does that at certain times, but only in the sense that since it was my first novel, I'm not an idiot, I was unafraid to really just be like, okay, these are my influences and I'm not going to hide who I like and I'm drawing upon. So, like, in some ways, I totally do, like, a mashup of Raymond Chandler and Philip K. Dick.
Mm.
But it's not, like, just taking who their characters are and throwing them together kind of thing. It's just, obviously, like, here's me trying to do a Raymond Chandler-type detective, but in a Philip K. Dick society.
Right, right.
Like, there's nothing too ingenious or revolutionary about that, but I wouldn't actually want to see, like, you know, Philip Marlowe teaming up with Deckard from Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep or anything like that.
Yeah. One of the things I'd like to see is all the Jack Kirby characters from the Bronze Age that aren't owned by Marvel and DC. Some sort of giant crossover involving all those characters. I would love to see. I hope someone comes up with that idea someday.
I want to see the Eternals and the New Gods mix it up.
Yes, I would. If that comic book series existed, who would you want to see write and draw it, though? Jodorowsky and Mobius. There you go. That's the answer.
That's a good answer.
Okay, moving on.
Okay, here's a long one from Alex C. that was in our comment section once. You're transported back in time to 1999.
All right.
A major publisher, Marvel or DC, take your pick, is compelled to offer you total editorial control of a comic series. You can hire any talent you want for any given issue and even write some of the comic yourself. You have access to a healthy amount of blah, 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 blah. Retaining the knowledge that you have of how history will play over the next 10 plus years, what do you do? Given that amount of freedom and foresight, what's the most you could do with one comic series to save the industry, the culture, and the world? 1999, you get one comic book series from Marvel or DC. You can do anything. What do you do?
$19.99. Well, you know what I would just do?
What would you do?
I would write it myself. And it would be Legion of Superheroes drawn by Promethea-era J.H. Williams. And that would, I don't care if it saves anybody, I'm just going to write it, and he's going to draw the heck out of it, and we're going to have fun. That's what I would do.
I wouldn't do something where it's me writing it. If only because I know that Well, that'd be fun and all. It wouldn't be great enough.
Oh, and mine would be great.
I'm trying to think of the right character and...
Especially in 1999, because I was 27, so I knew it all then. I knew everything in 27.
Okay. When did Morrison finish JLA? Was that 99 or later?
It couldn't have been later, because he did Marvel Boy in 2000, I believe.
Yeah.
I think it might have been 1998 that he finished JLA.
Yeah, 1998.
So you would reteam him and Howard Porter.
No, I would not use him. I wasn't going to use him on JLA. I would go the other way, and instead of the Authority, we have Warren Ellis unleashed on JLA.
Oh. Interesting. With who is the artist?
I'm trying to think. I'm not sure if I'd use Brian Hitch or not.
I put Frank Quitely on there. He hadn't done anything big at that point.
No, I don't think I'd do Quitely either. I think I'd go for someone more established. I think I'd somehow get...
Frank Miller.
No. That'd be kind of cool, though. Warren Ellis and Mobius. Doing Justice League of America with Warren Ellis, filtering all those big widescreen ideas from the Authority through JLA.
That'd be good, because that way my awesome Legion of Superheroes comic would have something to compete with, so that's a good idea.
And I've been outbid on Absolute Dark Knight.
I figured.
I love how neither one of us went for Marvel.
I was thinking for a minute about the Avengers, and then I said, no, I really don't care.
If I was going to do something for Marvel, I'd just stick Dan Klaus on Spider-Man.
You would do what?
Dan Klaus on Spider-Man.
Oh, okay. Gotcha.
Going kind of in the complete opposite direction of my DC move. Okay. We're down to three questions total. Joe G. asks, Matt Seneca on his Death to the Universe blog keeps making comments about Grant Morrison to the effect that Morrison has, quote-unquote, given up on boundary pushing in comics and is content to simply write above average but standard issue superhero comics. My question for you is, do you know what Matt is on about and do you agree with him? Didn't we talk about this a week or two ago?
We did, and short answer, I do agree with him. I don't think that's a bad thing. I think Morrison is just a middle-aged guy who's comfortable with the stuff that he's comfortable with at this point, and that's what happens. He's not going to be pushing the boundaries when he's creeping up on 50.
Yeah, that's a hard thing to keep doing.
I mean, Jack Kirby did it, but he's once in a lifetime. I think you can't be an angry young punk forever. At some point, you become the establishment. He is now firmly the establishment at DC. And even if he's doing things that not everybody is on board with, like he's the man. And what's he going to push into a new frontier? I don't know. I think that's just the way it is. That's fine.
Okay. And segueing into that, Matt Seneca asked, does your quote-unquote quality as objective idea go beyond Hero Comics? Like, is Watchmen better than Crazy Cat, than Acme, why, how?
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, it just does. Well, if I were to rank all three of them, it would be pretty clearly... Would it be Acme? It would definitely be Jimmy Corrigan. I'd say Acme. So Acme Novelty Library, then Watchmen would be significantly below that, but, you know, not... You know, it would be below that. And then Crazy Cat, I don't understand why everybody loves Crazy Cat. I get the formalist appeal, but Crazy Cat is not the masterpiece people make it out to be. It's just not. That's an objective fact. Matt Seneca, take that.
I haven't read or seen enough of Crazy Cat to really judge it.
They're all the same. It doesn't matter.
Okay, but still, I'm not going to make a judgment on something that I'm not as familiar with. At least once we're getting up to this type of judgment, I'm willing to judge plenty of stuff I'm not familiar with. But
Crazy Cat is the family circus of 1930. No, it's not. Oh. It's far better than that. But it's still just...
Is it the Calvin and Hobbes of 1930?
No, it's not. Calvin Hobbes is... I would put... I would put Calvin and Hobbes right below Acme Novelty Library and above Watchmen.
Yeah, I'd agree with that.
Calvin and Hobbes is pretty high for me. It might be higher than Acme Novelty Library. It depends on my mood. So, is that objective? Yes, I'm objectively changing my opinion based on my mood.
Do you feel like laughing, or do you feel like stabbing yourself in the eye?
Yes, I do think I know why Matt Seneca said that, and, but I still contend there you can have an objective set of criteria, and it's not even that hard to establish that. That doesn't mean that there can't be fluctuations in that objective set of criteria.
I think you can establish your set of objective criteria, but I still think it's ultimately going to come down to a subjective weighing of that criteria, a subjective choosing of the criteria, a subjective implementing of the criteria.
Sure, that's fair. Although, even within that, I think you can have an objective set of criteria that, because once you add the subjective element to it. This is totally like a quintessential splash page podcast because we're talking about this stupid question again. But once you start playing around with the subjective, then you start getting to the point where everything's relative, and that's not the case.
No, it's a mixture of both.
Clearly, Batman Arkham City is a worse comic by any set of standards that anyone reasonable with any experience would come up with is a worse comic than Punisher Max. They're very different comics, but Punisher Max does everything that Batman Arkham City does wrong. Punisher Max does better. So it's not totally subjective. And that's the point. That yes, there are nuances and there are slight differences, but some stuff is just better than others, and that's okay. That's how things are. It doesn't mean it's completely subjective.
I love how that's what you just said is something that I would have said. Because I'm totally the type of person who will just say, no, this is just better.
It just is.
Like, but I've always been... It seems to just be like our willingness to admit how much subjectivity plays into it.
Yes.
I'll give you like the base level of objective stuff, but then once you get beyond that base level, it's all subjective.
But I also think it depends on whether you're talking about just pure reaction opinion stuff or writing a review. I think your job as a reviewer is to activate the objective things a little bit more, whereas when I'm writing my column, I don't treat it that way. So it's a different mode. I don't always treat every comic with that same objective set of criteria.
Yeah, and I think that's been an area that we tend to agree on. Like, I was always willing to admit that, yes, I approach my reviews differently than I do other stuff. And that's been an area that we've talked about other reviewers. The reviewers who don't do that tend to be the ones that you and I both don't like.
Right. We would call them bad reviewers by an objective standard. And the objective standard would be, as a reviewer, you have to have a consistently objective set of criteria so that people understand what your evaluation means. If you just really happen to like Wally West, and so you give Wally West makes his appearance, so it's 4 stars, that might be an objective criteria, but it's a dumb one. And so you're not as good at your job, and that's also a fact. Sorry, anybody who likes Wally West and gives it 4 stars because he's in the comic.
I will say this. Every Wally West comic, better than every Barry Allen comic.
Disagree, but move on.
I don't know. If you totaled up all of the Barry Allen and all the Wally West comic books, which stack would you rather read?
You have only read...
I know, I haven't read much.
You have no frame of reference, sir.
Yeah, but I'm asking you, you've read more, which stack would you rather read?
It depends on my mood, because if I want do I want some sweet Carmine Infantino art and some like crazy Silver Age ideas, then I'll read Barry Allen. Do I want some Russian Jackson Geist drawn mutant running guys, then I'll read Wally West. Do I want, who's that guy, Chunk? Is he the big fat guy who has a black hole? I don't I don't really like Wally West comics, to be honest. I like some of the comics. They're just fine, but I like the Silver Age Flash better than almost all the Wally West comics, I'll be honest.
Okay. And the final lightning round question from Jim Tout. What great unified theory of comics should we take away from the Splash Page podcast? And this seems like an easy thing. That, from my perspective, it's that I'm always right about everything, but when we both agree, that's like extra right. And that's the theory about comics. Listen to us. If one of us says it, it's probably right. If we both agree on something, it's just objectively true.
It's just a fact.
Yeah.
Everything else in the world is an opinion.
Yeah. And then,
but
like,
if we agree, then it becomes a fact.
And if we disagree, then you just got to pick which guy you like better.
Right. And there's also the fact that we both might be wrong. That's also there, too.
No, I don't think that's a possibility.
I mean, I say that just to protect us from potential lawsuits.
I don't think there's a possibility we're both going to be wrong.
Oh, man. I think sometimes we just make it up as we go along. I think that's also the theme of this podcast.
Yeah.
But also, if you go back through our 50-plus episodes, we say the same things over and over a lot. So if you can't figure out the grand unified theory based on a listening of just a couple episodes, you haven't been paying attention. We don't tread new ground very often.
No, we don't.
That's our other motto. We don't even intentionally say, hey, let's talk about the same stuff again. But it ends up happening. Jeff Johns, Warren Ellis, Grant Morrison, criticism, objectivity versus subjectivity. We don't go much farther than that, I'll be honest.
Where else are we supposed to be going, man?
I don't know. I don't know anything else, Chad. That's all I know.
That's
the
thing, like,
I know that stuff really well.
Where are we supposed to be going? And even then, like, as we've shown, there's only a limited amount of distance you can go when only one of us is aware of a topic or a subject or anything. Like, you can get a little bit of distance out of that, but if both of us aren't on board, then it's usually you just rambling on for a few minutes while I go, uh-huh, and okay.
Right.
And then we move on to something else.
Like, we go, hey, let's talk about Len Wein comics. And be like, yeah, I've read some of those. I don't remember which ones he wrote. And then we'd be done talking. Or we could say, hey, let's talk about Chester Gould's early Dick Tracy. Be like, yeah, those exist. I don't know anything about that. Like, we don't have any other... We know some other things, but not enough that both of us can talk about it in depth.
Pretty much. Like, even if I... like, even stuff that you're aware of that I'm pretty specific into, like, again, there's not much we could talk about that, because unless both of us kind of really have some strong thoughts on it, it's not going to go very far.
What do you think, this would be the final question about this, I guess. Out of all the things that we haven't talked about, what do you think we both know the most about that just hasn't really come up on the podcast to any substantial depth?
What an odd question to ask in the sense of, like, how do you think of that?
Well, because I'm sure there are things that we both have a decent amount of knowledge on, either a certain arc or certain series, and we just have never talked about it. Probably something that isn't one of the major things of the 80s that's like a milestone and isn't currently published, so we would have no reason to talk about it.
Maybe the Milligan All Red X-Force.
There you go. That's a good one.
That's a good one. We never really... I guess we talked about Frank Miller a bit. We never really, really talked about... It came up a little bit from time to time, but we usually talked about it in the broader sense of Frank Miller. We never really talked about his Batman stuff in any real depth.
No, we didn't. I think we've mentioned it more than certainly the Milligan Allred X-Force Ecstatics, which, yeah, I could talk about at length, but we haven't never really talked
or
about
Or even that's something we were just sort of talking about, even glossed over. Chris Ware and Acme Novelty Library.
True.
Let me think. Probably all sorts of other stuff. We never really talked about the Invisibles to any great degree. We talked about Grant Morrison in other areas, but the Invisibles we never talked about.
Nope.
We briefly mentioned, like, we mentioned the art thing a little bit. There's all sorts. We never talked about, like, Sleeper. Ed Brubaker, Sean Phillips, we probably could have talked about that.
That's a fact. I don't know that I would have much to say about that, but I read
it. Well, I mean, I'm sure we would have come up with some stuff. We never talked about Paul Jenkins and Jay Lee's Inhumans.
You know what we've never talked about? We've never talked about EC Comics at all. Have you read
any
EC
Comics? I have nothing
Comics?
To say. I've never really read
it. See, I would have no idea if you had or not, because we've never even talked about any of those creators, really. Except maybe Wally Wood once in a while, like mentioned in passing.
No, I've never really read any of those.
How about 2000 AD stuff? Judge Dredd or...
I haven't encountered much of that.
Nemesis.
I read a recent PDF of Judge Dredd magazine that I was going to review for CBR, but then didn't. More because I didn't have a lot to say. Like, ultimately, like, I started writing a review, and it was basically how this would be a fine magazine, except it's not as good as Clint. And I don't, like, love Clint. It's just like, dudes, how are you publishing this when Mark Miller's putting out something with way more comic content? Way more comic content that's going to appeal to people, and doing it for, like, half the price.
That's a good point.
And I'm like, that's...
Is Clint still around? I haven't heard anything about it.
Yeah, it still comes out, I guess.
Right. That's exactly how everybody feels about Clint. It still comes out, I guess.
Yeah, I mean... I don't... Another comment, like, why aren't they... Titan people, why are you not still sending me that?
I know, I'll take stuff for free.
Every time a new one came, we talked about it, or I reviewed it, or wrote about it somewhere.
Didn't Titan or Rebellion send out a press release? Did you get that?
No.
And it was an announcement about... Oh, that's what they're doing. They're doing a hardcover edition of the Bisley, Pat Mills... It's spelled Slain, the Horn God, but it's pronounced like... Schlarn or something. I forget how you pronounce it. That's coming out in a hardcover edition, and I want that, because that's Bisley at his best. That's Bisley of the Doom Patrol covers.
We never talked about Doom Patrol, really.
No.
Besides that little bit of New X-Men today, we never really talked about that.
We talked about Bendis a lot.
Talked about Bendis a lot. We talked about Geoff Johns.
A lot.
More than you'd expect from where one of the guys has no interest in that guy's writing. We talked about Warren Ellis. We talked about Grant Morrison, more like his, whatever he's doing now.
Yeah.
At the time.
Try to keep it current for the people.
We never really got too far into Casanova in any discussion about that.
Do you have any regrets about the podcast, Chad Nemet?
All the horrible, stupid, thoughtless things I said.
All the time that we wasted saying nothing, which could have been a lot of time, for all I know.
Ultimately, no. No regrets.
No regrets. It was good times. It was good talking to you.
Even, like, the podcast existing led to a couple times where I talked to Sean Witzke for a few hours each time.
Yeah.
Including, let's be honest, like, the strangest podcast ever just pop up, a random Christmas Eve podcast.
The saddest Christmas Eve podcast ever.
I know, it's like, wow, look at this. Two guys who are sad and lonely just being like, you want to talk about comics and movies and stuff?
The sad cast.
The sad cast. Got to talk to Joe Casey and find out that he doesn't hate me.
Yeah, that was a high point, Chad.
Unless, of course, he was lying.
No, he wasn't lying.
He could have been lying.
He sent me an email the other day, or not the other day, last week, and he was like, hey, you guys are coming up on episode 50. Is that a special occasion?
Really?
Yeah. And I didn't reply back. Yes, I'm quitting. But I guess I could.
Do you know what would be that's just a weird thought, the idea that, I don't know why I find it weird, but the idea that he would sit down and listen to these at all, I find that odd. I find that strange that, like, any sort of comic professional is listening to these, and there are ones who do.
So for all you comic book professionals out there, keep doing the job, because yeah. I'm, even though Jason Horn thinks I'm going to stop reading comics, I am never going to stop reading comics, even though I am almost 40, and that is too old for comics.
That's way too old for comics.
It's too old. That's one of my favorite parts about the Wait What podcast, is when Jeff Lester talks about He's like, at some point, you're too old to wear T-shirts anymore. Like the logo T-shirt, or like, you know, the T-shirt that has the Batman symbol on it. And he's like, I think I'm already past that point, and I haven't realized it yet. And I can totally relate to that. At a certain point, you gotta stop wearing T-shirts. But yet, it's not like I wear them to work. But honestly, I have a lot of T-shirts I wear all summer.
I wear T-shirts to work when I can.
Yes,
but not, I don't have
we're
any
not
comic
40.
Book T-shirts. Yeah, but I also don't really have any like comic book T-shirts or anything like that. I'm just somewhat like T-shirts.
All right, I think it's time to wrap it up. Any final words, Chad Nevitt?
Coming next week, I read all of Martial Law out loud.
The sad cast part two.
Yeah. And try my best to describe Kevin O'Neill's art.
And I'll be spending next Friday night probably talking to another live human being who's actually in my presence.
Yeah, I'll probably either watch a baseball game or wrestling.
Wow.
You know, what I'd do on any Friday night where Tim wasn't able to do the podcast.
And if you want to book Chad or I for a guest appearance on your podcast, just call our manager. He'll take care of it.
We have a manager?
I think we'll have to get one. We're going to be such in-demand podcasters.
Yeah, I assume we're both open. Although I'd find it funny if you started doing a lot of guest appearances now.
Like every week?
Like, it's like, yeah, he quits because he wants more time, and then, oh wait, he starts popping up on every other podcast around. Like me popping up everywhere. It's like, okay, this guy, he was still cool. He was going to keep doing it. He would like, I have a hole to fill that I'm okay filling. You shouldn't like appear online except for your column from now on.
Hey, maybe I just want to talk to other people, Chad. It's not you, it's me.
That makes it sound like it's me. I want to talk to other people makes it sound like no, it's me.
Yeah, okay. I'm interested to see what would happen. I mean, I'm sure we'll end up like doing things with other podcasters at some point because we. Like, all of our friends online are podcasters.
Well, plus, we've already done stuff with other people in podcasts for
but,
this.
Like, we keep... How much of our things that we talk about will change when we're talking to other people? You know, are we still going to cycle back to the same five topics over and over? Or is that just because it's the two of us? I don't know the answer to that. And I don't plan on making a lot of appearances on podcasts. Here's my prediction. Here's my over-under on that. I bet between now and December I will appear on 3 podcasts. That's my guess.
I assume I will appear on none, because, well, nobody's asked me so far, and I don't see that changing anytime soon.
Hmm. Well, that sounds like an open call to invite Chad to be on your podcast.
And I'm not counting the 411 Mania podcast where I call in.
Right.
Because that's a little bit different.
Well, I think when Alex Ross starts his Silver Age Fan Club podcast, you'll be the first one he calls.
Oh, I'm honestly surprised that we haven't had, like, Kurt Busiek wanting to kill us because someone decided to point out last week's podcast. I could see Alex Ross not caring or not having anybody tell him because...
Well, you'll note that I said nothing bad, so he wouldn't kill me.
Yeah, but that doesn't... Well, but oddly, you'd get lumped in just because.
I was mostly just laughing at you, and then...
Yeah, but for...
And then saying, you know what, I'm probably going to read that series.
Like, the only time that's ever happened was with Ivan Brandon.
Right.
Where we said something and then it got back to him and it became a little bit of a thing, but I was really expecting, just because I was so over the top, to someone to just say, like, did you hear this? And then, but then again, Kurt Busiek could be the type of guy who's like, I don't care.
And to be fair, someone from the company did call me the next day.
Really?
Yeah, I talked to you about this.
No, you didn't.
I talked to you before we started recording.
Oh, yeah, that thing. I was thinking of something like when you said someone from the company.
Well, someone from the company.
Yeah, but
turns out to be unrelated. But I was like, oh man, I wonder if he listened to our podcast last night where Chad was going off.
Yeah, but you were talking about like.
Anyway, we can't talk about
yeah,
it. Stop
yeah, secret. I know, but you know what I mean, like.
We'll end it on that note of mystery and top secretiveness, and I have had an enjoyable time, Chad Nevitt, and I am looking forward to the day when you will finally make a physical appearance in the lower 48.
make a physical appearance in the lower 48 on Tuesday night when I go to a Blue Jays-Tigers game in Detroit.
Well, I won't be there.
Well, that's your tough luck.
But I'll see you at the New York Comic Con, probably 2013.
Well, whenever I get off these horrible weekend shifts and still have a job.
Well, good luck to you, sir. And farewell to everybody, because this is it for me. I'm signing out, and so is Chad Nevitt forever.
And should I add another piece of music to end these things?
I think so.
So, okay, we'll end with Sleep is the Enemy by Danko Jones.
Farewell.
Later, man.
Hey! I'm ready!